Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Yes, we're going to be talking about the Mega Millions fantasies going on as we speak. Dollars dancing in the head and right before Christmas. What a wonderful thought. I can win the Mega Millions. I think you got like one in 650 million shot. But hey, I guess it's a shot. But you know, it's the magic season and anything could happen, right? Or as, you know, as I always thought, 'tis the season to be swindled. But we'll talk about a little bit about that. Also, minimum wage on the docket. Looks like there's some discussion on, can we get the low-wage economy boosted a little bit and then help the entire economy? We'll talk about what happened in Harrisburg today as the General Assembly decided, or at least a sliver of the Republican Party decided, hey, we're going to go after local control, consolidate power. Talk about that. Also, you may be dreaming of a white Christmas, but at Fake News at Fox, it's all over white Santa. Yes, yes, white Santa was white. Did you know? Of course you knew. I actually never thought about it. I thought he was red with the big red rosy cheeks. But the question is, was it a dumb comment or an ideological predisposition? If you're going to get a job at Fake News at Fox, do you have to think that way? I think you do. Also, another GOPer. Pimping the frame of how the Affordable Care Act's horrible, it's terrible, it's worse than Stalin and Hitler combined, it's worse than the plague, oh, it's horrible. Getting people health care, horrible, it's a death trap. Or death panels, if you buy the Sarah Palin line. Also going to talk about the Volcker Rule, family values, and much more, whatever's on your mind, thoughts, questions, comments. You can email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com, or give us a call here at the studio, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Before we begin the big broadcast, I want to thank all of those people over the weekend who took to the roads, did the plowing and the salting and made our roads safe. When I went out Sunday morning on my weekly road trip, the roads were in great condition. And those people deserve our appreciation, deserve our thank you. So if you're one of those, thank you very much. I hope we all appreciate the work that they do. And I promise I will work not to steal your pension. Now, there are some in our state, very much so, want to steal those state workers' pensions, put it in the hands of Wall Street, or just cut it all together. I'm not one of them. But thank you anyway. So let's begin the big program with a Bill Moyer quote. John sent me this quote and thought I could use it, and I can because it fits perfectly into the beginning of the program. Bill Moyer said, in one way or another, this is the oldest story in America, the struggle to determine whether we, the people, is a moral compact embedded in a political contract, or merely a charade masking as piety and manipulated by the powerful and privileged to sustain their own way of life at the expense of others. And I thought, you know, that's a perfect way to begin today's program, especially on the day after the big New York City trip. And it may have been cold here in Pennsylvania, and the roads may have been covered in ice, and you may have had those workers out there busting their behind, putting their lives on the line to clear our roads and streets. But it was hot, hot, hot in New York City as our big politicos and the overlord corporate masters wined and dined and decided how they were going to divvy up more of our assets. Did you get to attend any of the big gala events at the Pennsylvania Society held in New York City at the famed Waldorf Astoria Hotel? Oh, what a beautiful place. I've never been there. Seen pictures. Very, very, very amazing place. The amazing, incredible work of master craftsmen. Working class people who could never stay there, understand. You know, the people who built that hotel could never stay there. They never earned enough to actually spend a night in the hotel, let alone have dinner or any of that other stuff. But they built it. They built, you know, you look at all the things that the hands of we, the working people, have created that we never get to really enjoy. And I look at this Pennsylvania Society weekend as just that, a throwback to the good old days of the robber barons where, you know, they kind of did it in secret more. Now it's kind of just obnoxious. But 114 years ago when this began in 1899, the people who own the state. The big industrialists, the Gilded Age bankers, the Carnegies, the Fricks, the wealth of the state would gather there for Delmonico steaks and oysters. And, of course, those politicians who they had in their pocket, it was kind of a, hey, thanks for all the work that you've done for us. And I guess after 114 years, you got to go, what's changed? You still see the big politicos, you still see the power brokers, you see the lobbyists and the lawyers and the big corporations holding receptions. There were more than 60 receptions and parties over the three-day weekend with free everything. Free everything if you're invited. Now, I didn't get my invitation. Did you get your invitation? I must have gotten lost in the mail. No, wait a minute. That's a cheap shot. And I promised myself I wasn't going to make any more of those cheap shots because it's too easy to cop out that way. To be honest, I don't ever remember having anything of mine lost in the mail. I guess it's just easy for us to fall back on those stories and those talking points that high society folk saddle us with, isn't it? I mean, it's easy, isn't it? Because I don't ever remember sending anything and it not getting there in the Postal Service. Our Postal Service does an amazing job, which is why the wealth class wants to privatize it so that they can monetize it even more and put the money in their pocket. But that's a whole rant for another day. But, did you get your invitation? Because I didn't. I guess I'm not on that list. And that list are, people that can be used by big business, people that can be used by the very well-to-do. And understand, I'm sure there were tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars pledged to campaigns, pledged to politicians, special favors being traded. This, to me, is one huge incestuous pool of everything that is wrong with our political system, where moneyed interests have more control than we, the people. Understand, the power of this nation is derived from we, the people. And the sad reality is, we, the people, we weren't at the Pennsylvania Society dinner. We weren't at this more than 60 receptions where elbows were rubbed and, I'll look into that for you, by Mike Terzai, the majority leader. Didn't tell me that, but did tell corporate lobbyists that. And this is something that we, the people, should be infuriated with. I mean, aside from the fact that it was held in New York City, that being another argument, why wasn't it in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia or Reading or Allentown or Scranton or Harrisburg, which could use the money, or even right here, right in my backyard? If we're going to spend a lot of money selling off Pennsylvania, shouldn't we at least let some of it trickle down in Pennsylvania? I mean, maybe you've got a different thought. Maybe where the wealthy industrialists and the people who own Pennsylvania live is New York, and they don't want to commute to Pennsylvania. I guess I understand that. Because if you go back to when this whole thing started, most of the people who own the big industries in the state lived in New York. So, they didn't want to drive to that place over there. They wanted those politicians to come begging to them. And I look at this and I go, what's changed in 114 years? I mean, as I look at this, we should be flipping mad. And I was reading one of the reports from the big gala. And they had Ed Rendell there, and he was given a speech, and evidently this is his 36th annual visit. So for 36 years he's been going to this, and he said, I wouldn't have known what to do this weekend if I stayed home. He said, for politicians, it's like salmon swimming upstream to give birth. We do it by instinct. Now, I don't know if that was supposed to be flattery to the people who put this on, to the Console Energy and the Marcellus Shale Coalition and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association and all the big business special interests with their trough handed right out, going, please, put your snout right in. I don't know if he meant it to be tongue-in-cheek. I don't know if he meant to be in that instinct to me, well, you know, it just is what it is, or if he meant it in sarcasm, that in order to get along, you've got to play along. And I've been having a lot of these conversations lately with people who I'm trying to encourage to run for political office. And I think I've got a couple people who are going to throw their hat into the ring, if for nothing else, to expose more of this kind of obscenity, more of this kind of abuse. And I know you might say, you know, it's just a dinner party. What does it matter? What it matters, the sole intent of this Pennsylvania society ball, gala, dinner, reception, 60 parties, invitations, is to influence the people that we put into power to wine and dine and fill with special favors and gratuities the people that are supposed to be doing our work, supposed to be looking out for our children, supposed to be looking out for our interests. But who was there for us? Who was in their ear saying, you know what? Our education system is struggling and needs help. But I'll guarantee you the private for-profit education industry was there with a party of their own. Hey, come on, free booze. Let me tell you about a great education opportunity I got. Here, have another drink. This is the kind of stuff that goes on. And it's infuriating. And this is why I say we need to have good, decent, honest people run for these positions, even if you lose, and hold people accountable. Now, look, I truly believe that there are a lot of good people in government. I truly believe there are a lot of people who want to do the right thing, and it's easy to throw pot shots and to paint with a broad brush and say, oh, they're all crooks. I don't believe that. I do believe we've allowed a system to grow. We've allowed a system to exist that forces even the people who are there, the good, decent, honest people who are really fighting for we the people, we have allowed a system that forces them to places like that to beg for resources so that they can stay elected. And because of the money, because of the campaign system that we've allowed to build up around it, we've forced even the really great, honest, decent people to have to swim in that cesspool. Which, again, is why I'm a big fan of campaign finance reform, publicly financed elections. Get the big moneyed interests. Get their hands out of our government. Just my thought. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'll talk a little bit about the minimum wage, a little bit about the local control, and there's some talk of shrinking the size of the General Assembly. Good thing, bad thing? We'll find out when we come back. Quick break.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. L&M Hospital in New London, Connecticut has agreed to resume talks Monday to end the lockout of nearly 800 union nurses and healthcare techs. The AFT locals representing the healthcare workers say it's good news for the patients and all people in the region served by the hospital. The union insisted that its entire membership be allowed to sit in on the talks, so a federal mediator will be used to shuttle proposals back and forth between the union and management. The union says the talks are expected to focus on the core issue, the future of patient care delivery at L&M Hospital and its subsidiaries.
The Milwaukee Community Coalition, backing the fast food workers movement for $15 an hour and the right to form unions, is behind an effort now to get dozens of fired McDonald's workers reinstated. The workers were abruptly fired with no explanation by the McPiles Corporation, owner of the three McDonald's stores where they worked. The boss is a capitalist pastor known in his military days as Robert McDonald's Piles. He owns at least 11 McDonald's stores in Milwaukee and is senior pastor at Milwaukee's Abundant Faith Church of Integrity. Jennifer Epps Addison is executive director of Wisconsin Jobs Now. She says the community must take a stand to get these workers back to work and demand that Pastor Piles act in accordance with his professed faith to treat these workers justly in this holiday season.
Some of them actually showed up to work and found out that they didn't have a job anymore. This is not what we expect out of any business owner, but certainly not a business owner that's a pastor right before Christmas. This is why people want unions, because the best way to resolve a difficult challenge or even hiring decisions is to sit down across from the people who are making the profits in your stores and to negotiate a fair deal for that. We hope that the union will be able to help Pastor Piles negotiate a fair deal with these workers so that everybody can have a happy holiday season and go into the new year with safe and secure families.
59 locked out Chicago area Teamsters funeral employees have won their unfair labor practices charge against Service Corporation International. The National Labor Relations Board found merit in several of the charges filed by Teamsters Local 727. But Local 727 Secretary Treasurer John Coley says that while thankful the board ruled in the workers' favor, the punishment doesn't fit the crime. Coley says the company's actions have grossly and negatively impacted the workers, and the company deserves a harsher penalty. The company had to acknowledge that they broke the law and notify the workers that they won't do it anymore. SCI has refused a Teamsters offer for the workers to return to work. The NLRB found that SCI illegally spied on union activity, threatened members with loss of vacation, and unlawfully solicited the workers to withdraw from the union. The workers have been locked out for 5 months.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Gasoline, groceries, and our hate is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Got an email during the break from Brian who points out that that the servers at the Pennsylvania Society dinner at the unionized Waldorf Astoria Hotel, they wore stickers right there on their lapel supporting workers in Pennsylvania as, you know, we've got a Republican-led General Assembly who's pushing House Bill 1807 that would take away local control and... Well, not allow local cities and municipalities and towns and boroughs to say that, well, we want workers to have paid sick days in our local community. Which is kind of interesting because, you know, you think the Republicans, they keep talking about local control, but when it's their turn, not so much. Just is what it is. Anyway, minimum wage has been high on the order of things in the world, which is why we've asked Pennsylvania State Representative Mark Cohen to come talk to us. Mark, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you very much, Rick.
So the big Pennsylvania Society dinner over the weekend where the big wealthy industrialists and the hobnobbers were rubbing elbows. Did you get your invitations?
I got an invitation. Amazingly, I had other things to do.
I can imagine. So walk me through this. You're going to put forth a piece of legislation, as I understand it, that would give local communities the ability to raise the minimum wage, which evidently right now is banned in the state of Pennsylvania?
That's right. It's banned under Pennsylvania law.
How does that happen?
How did it happen that it got banned?
Yes.
It was necessary to ban it in order to get support to raise it from 515 to 715.
And I would assume it's the people who keep telling us that they believe in local control, right?
That's right.
So the pound of flesh that we had to give was take away local control and give it to the state because they know better.
Yeah, at the time it didn't seem like a terrible sacrifice. I had talked to councilmen over the years about raising the minimum wage in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia's got the most progressive and pro-labor council in the state, but there wasn't any interest in doing that. So it didn't seem to me like we were giving up an awful lot. But now that other places all over the country are raising the minimum wage, and now there's been substantial change in the membership of the city council over time, you know, my hope would be that Philadelphia and Harrisburg and Pittsburgh and perhaps other places would be interested in raising the minimum wage and pushing the debate higher. In California and Washington State and New Mexico, there have been all sorts of high minimum wage increases, which have shown that the raising the minimum wage does not cause jobs. That's the big argument among the people who like to go to the Pennsylvania Society, that you raise the minimum wage, you lose jobs. So they're pro jobs by fighting for lower wages.
Yeah,
and that just doesn't work in the real world.
Yeah, and I understand you also have another piece of legislation to raise the minimum wage up to over a time period up to $11.50 an hour, and then
for me,
more importantly, indexing it for inflation so that we don't have to have these fights every 5, 6, 7, 8 years when the minimum wage has been eroded by inflation.
I agree with that. I would like to raise it for inflation, but we got to raise it. We got to raise the number, too.
Absolutely. No, I'm with you.
Because if we just leave it at 7.25 and say, well, it's 7.25 and we'll just index it to inflation, there's a bill that does that in the legislature, and that's no good because that'll just keep it too low. It's, the minimum wage is too low now, and we have to fight to raise it.
You know, I remember back in 2006, you know, we here at the program did everything we could do to get the minimum wage raised up to 7.15. I remember, you know, the chant 7.15, nothing in between. And, you know, I've got the little pen and the little piece of paper from Governor Rendell to say, hey, the pen doesn't work, though. But I got the little pen and piece of paper, and I remember at the time going, this isn't enough. We've got to stop this. We shouldn't have to, you know, 5, 6, 7, 10 years down the road, have to fight it again. And here we are. You know, last time it was raised in Pennsylvania, 2006. Then the federal government raised it a little bit. Here we are again, back fighting this fight again.
Well, you know, I think we get more over the long haul if we demand higher wages, not just in inflation indexes. The inflation rate right now is pretty low. In the year ending at the end of October for the Philadelphia metropolitan area, which is broadly defined by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, so it includes parts of New Jersey and Maryland and Delaware. Inflation was up all of 0.25%, last year. That's the government figures. You know, medical inflation is always higher than that.
Right.
Senior citizen inflation is usually higher than that. Partly because of medical expenses and prescriptions and the need for prosthetics and other aids to daily living. I favor aggressively seeking to get the numbers as high as possible. Certainly one way to get the numbers up is the cost of living. Washington State was for many years the number one state in the country. It passed the 7.25 plus the COLA bill a long time ago, and its minimum wage is up to $9.32. But California is in all likelihood going to pass Washington State with a $10 minimum wage, and there's an effort to raise the minimum wage in California by a referendum question now to $12. And Massachusetts is likely to have a new minimum wage over $10. There's a Senate bill that passed the state Senate to raise it to $11, and there's a proposed referendum to raise it to $10.50, and the referendum is sort of back up.
Yeah, there's a lot of places that are looking at doing it, but don't you think we need to have the adult conversation? Because I've heard too many people say, well, we can't. It's going to cost jobs, like you said. It's going to hurt employers. It's going to do all this stuff. Can't we have the adult conversation that's saying, you know, we're already heavily subsidizing, we the taxpayers are subsidizing minimum wage employees through, you know, food stamps, through Medicaid, through LIHEAP, through all these programs, and shouldn't we be moving away from a low-wage economy that depends on the taxpayer and have companies like Walmart and McDonald's and these other huge companies who've made their billions off of exploiting not just the workers but also the taxpayers? Isn't that something we should be talking about heavily?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's growing understanding. You know, for years, the minimum wage has been defeated both by open opposition and by more subtle opposition, focusing the attention of largely federal but also state governmental policymakers. What can we do to help the poor?
And, give them jobs.
You know, and so there's really been trillions of dollars over the years of federal subsidy to low-wage workers. And that's basically taxpayers subsidizing employers for hiring low-wage workers and driving wage levels down.
And not for the low end of the scale, but for the entire scale. I mean, that's the other part I think people forget. And, you know, I had this conversation recently where, you know, I had a guy who's making like $15, $18 an hour saying, well, it doesn't affect me. I go, it damn does affect you. If the guy at the bottom who's making 7 1/4 now is making 10, that means you've got to bump up too. And that's the reason big business is so deadly opposed to it. It's not because the guy at the bottom is going to get anything. They just don't want everybody getting a little something.
Yeah, I agree with that. It boosts the general wage rate, and it boosts the average wage rate, and that's important. So the guy who's earning $15 an hour shouldn't feel, hey, I'm really rich. I'm earning $15 an hour. Look at this guy earning the minimum wage. I earn twice as much as he does. You know, I think people ought to know that there is a minimum acceptable standard of living for people who are working, and that we ought not to be trying to subsidize employers to pay lower wages.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you something, Representative Cohen. You know, one of the things that always blows my mind is, and maybe you hear these stories too. I'm sure you hear them probably as much, if not more often than I do, that, you know, someone saw someone at the supermarket and they had the WIC card or the EBT card and they're whatever. We're subsidizing them. But you never hear them go, you know, I went to McDonald's and there was that person behind the counter, you know, making minimum wage, and I'm subsidizing this big, huge multinational. So I guess the question is, why is it that we focus on the people behind us who are struggling to get by and not the people that are really on our backs and that we're really supporting?
Well, I guess we kind of focus on people who are ahead of. We can look at the minimum wage guy and say, hey, I'm a big success. Look how much I make. Look how much he makes. You know, we don't want to compare ourselves to millionaires and billionaires and admit that other people have been far more economically successful than we have been.
Or that we've created. I mean, I look at the billionaire list, the Forbes 400, and I go, look at all the wealth that we've created for these folks that we didn't get to share in, which is why I'm a huge supporter of labor unions and the ability of collective bargaining to say, you know what, if the skill of our hands and the ache of our back create some wealth, we should have a piece of it.
I agree. And I've always believed that. My parents were union organizers in the 1930s, and they believe that, and the base, you know, minimum wage is one of a small number of tools we have to raise average income in America. Certainly, building up the union movement is another tool, and it's a more important tool. You know, I would certainly believe that we ought to be focusing a lot more effort on building up the union movement.
I'm right there with you. Because do you think those servers at the Pennsylvania Society dinner would dare to put a sticker on their lapel to supporting Pennsylvania workers and not having their rights stolen away if they didn't have a voice and the ability to be protected and under a contract? Do you think that would happen? I'd say not.
Yeah, it's certainly difficult. I mean, you know, all too many people have gotten fired for union advocacy in the workplace, and there's very little under the current labor laws. There's ban against firing people for advocating union, but it's got such weak penalties and such high standards of proof,
yep.
It doesn't do very much good.
You know, I'm always amazed that you hear the very well-to-do in this country complaining about how powerful unions are when you're talking about 7% of the private sector workforce. I don't know the last time 7% of the country had the kind of influence that the wealth class claims they have. I wish they had that power, because then we wouldn't see stagnating and declining standard of living in this country. If we had the power that the mainstream media keeps saying labor has, we would actually see a growing, burgeoning middle class like my grandparents' generation fought for.
That's right. Certainly the growth of labor is needed to have a middle class. I think we need general public awareness that middle class salaries are good. And we ought to try to raise the salaries of as many people as we possibly can, and not just have an endless race to the bottom.
Yep.
And say, gee, we could save a little money on the on this or that good if we pay lower salaries. We're just cannibalizing ourselves and driving down our own standard of living when we engage in that kind of thinking. And people ought to be demanding of elected officials they take steps to raise salaries. And that had been from Franklin Roosevelt through Lyndon Johnson, that had been the standard Democratic and labor agenda in this country. And then inflation became a big worry, and people got away from that. It may be that you have to take action against inflation, but we fought inflation very successfully now for decades, and it's time to focus on raising the standards of living American workers.
And going back to a full employment policy.
And go back to a full employment policy in which the jobs are well paid.
Absolutely, and
we got to try to just make people aware that when they buy foreign goods, I'm pleased to push through a Buy American bill. It's the broadest Buy American bill ever passed in Pennsylvania. We got it through the House, it's now awaiting action in the Senate. We got to do everything we possibly can in government, outside of government, to push people to recognize that how they spend their money, whether they buy American or they buy often cheaper bills, often cheaper goods made in foreign countries by people earning very, very little money, that's an important factor in maintaining their lifestyle.
And I think that starts from the government down as well, Representative. It blows my mind that the Pennsylvania Society spent their money in New York. Why isn't the Pennsylvania Society spending money in Pennsylvania?
That would be very good if it would.
I mean, to me, it starts with government procurement. It starts right down the line. Things that our government uses should be made in Pennsylvania if it's made here.
Well, maybe people ought to be pushing to have the Pennsylvania. I think the Philadelphia City Council passed a resolution some years ago calling for the Pennsylvania Society to be moved to Pennsylvania. Maybe the AFL-CIO ought to do it. The Pennsylvania Society is a nonprofit organization that can legally do whatever it wants.
Sure.
It's not an arm of government.
No, I understand that. But
it attracts people in government, and people, perhaps ought to use their influence, who are really active in the Pennsylvania Society, to get it there. And also, whatever the board of directors of the Pennsylvania Society decides to do, people can organize competing events in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, and I think some people ought to try to do that.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, it's like herding cats. It's where the food is. And,
right.
Where the campaign donations are and where all of that stuff sat is, well, there at the Waldorf Astoria, like it's been for 114 years. No, it just is what it is. I want to ask you a couple other quick questions.
Sure.
This House Bill 1807 put forth by Seth Grove, the Republican. Again, this idea that local control is best that, you know, our GOP friends throw out. Yet this piece of legislation takes local control away, consolidates it at the hands of the state, much like they did banning the minimum wage. This takes away the ability for local government agencies, city councils, whatever, to pass paid sick vacation day ordinances. So I guess none of that then, huh?
That's right. Well, they're trying. But I think we ought to have the votes to beat that.
But to me, it sends that message of, you know, whose bidding are they doing? It's definitely not my bidding. It's definitely not the bidding of the working people in this Commonwealth who are struggling to make ends meet. So, you know, the reason I throw this out there is I think the voting public needs to know which side of the aisle these and which side of the debate our friends on the that are going to support this are on.
There is both a deep belief that the political party affiliation is of only minor relevance. And there's growing evidence that it's of stupendous relevance. And then the popular belief that it's of little relevance has less and less basis in reality. It really makes a major difference in the lives of individuals, whether the Democratic or Republican Party is in office. And it's really important that the popular belief that there's little, if any, difference between the parties be confronted, because it just leads people to making dumb decisions. I am, you know, I'm appalled at these rural areas where there's massive poverty and low wages year after year, decade after decade, elect Republican legislators by landslide margins who proceed to vote year after year, decade after decade against the economic interests of their constituents.
Yep.
It's ridiculous.
And it's mind-blowing. And the things that they sell are only there to harm. I mean, I look at the transportation bill. It was the Republicans who pushed mightily to gut prevailing wage laws that help workers earn a reasonable wage and, in my view, use tax dollars in a more constructive way by helping the local economy. But, you know, the Republicans, they wanted, that's their ideological get. If they can just, we can ruin that. Life would be so much wonderful, and they've cracked the door open with it.
That's right. It was ridiculous that they insisted on pushing on raising the prevailing wage cap.
So we're going to raise
the
taxes.
Transportation bill, it had nothing whatever to do with it.
We're going to raise taxes on gas. We're going to raise fees. We're going to raise all of the things that cost average everyday working people. We're going to raise that on them, but we're going to cut their wages simultaneously. It's just mind-blowing. Last thing I did want to ask, also a push, and this has been going on for a number of years, so I'm not sure how long in the process this is, but this idea that we're going to reduce the size of the legislature. I'm personally opposed to it. For a very simple reason. If there are fewer people to buy, it's less costly for the wealth, for the Pennsylvania society folks. But I'd like to hear what your thought is.
I absolutely agree with that. I'm one of the leading opponents of it. I think it's absolutely a terrible thing. The argument you're making about buying the legislature by vested interests who are hostile to the welfare of the average person. That was the argument that pushed the Constitutional Convention in 1873 to double the size of the legislature. And at that time, there were something like 3.1 or 3.2 million people in Pennsylvania. You know, today, we're getting closer and closer to 13 million. The latest figure, I think, has us about 12.8 million of people. So the size of the legislative districts in terms of number of people have more than quadrupled since that took effect. There's absolutely no reason why we have to reduce the size of the legislature. At best, you know, the most optimistic estimate is you save $8 million, which is a grand total of 2.5% of the state legislative budget, and the state legislative budget itself is only 1%. Of the state budget, so we're saving virtually nothing by doing it, but we're cutting out public input, And when we're strengthening obvious, they've got fewer fundraisers to go through. They give people more money. They can be more influential in selected districts. One of the great strengths of the current system is that there always are going to be people who are unaffected by any issue that comes up.
Right.
So there'll be some people with an open mind. And the more you cut the size of the district, the number of people with an open mind is going to go down.
Yeah, I'm all in favor personally of a larger legislature and taking the drawing of the districts completely out of the political process. Maybe looking at some alternatives like they have in Iowa or California, but definitely not giving it to the party in power so that they remain in power. It just seems dumb to me.
Yeah, well, we in the Democratic Party all voted for amendments for nonpartisan redistricting. Most of us also voted as an alternative to have a unicameral legislature instead of a bicameral legislature. You know, we tried everything we could to present alternatives that the Republicans might buy.
Well,
and they made clear, you know, except for isolated individuals here and there, that they're determined to reduce the size of the legislature and juggle the system to keep ordinary citizens out.
And that is, in my view, the bottom line of it. Representative Cohn, I appreciate you taking time for us. I hope you have a great holiday and look forward to talking to you in the new year.
Thank you, Rick.
Thanks so much. Same. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Do we shrink the size of the legislature? Raise the minimum wage? What do you think? Right back after this.
Blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The scandalous saga of the Wall Street bailout continues, for bank regulators are now watering down Congress's pathetically weak reforms. However, during the past 4 years, one fellow has shown some regulatory backbone, proposing rules to prevent a repeat of the whole sorry saga. He is Gary Gensler, head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and he's dared to push the Treasury Secretary and other major bank overseers to join him in seriously limiting Wall Street's cavalier proliferation of complex derivatives. Analysts describe these convoluted schemes as poorly disclosed, poorly understood, and could lay waste to the economy. Good for Gensler, right? Yes, but of all the agency heads who are involved in writing new banking rules, guess which one was not invited this year by President Obama to stay on the job? Yes, the tough one, the one actually trying to protect the people, the one not afraid to offend Wall Street greed heads, Gary Gensler. He's being replaced by Timothy Massad, who appears to be more of an industry lapdog than a watchdog. Massad, a career insider, has been a corporate lawyer for banks, a lickspittle lieutenant for Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, himself an infamous Wall Street softie, and a blocker of tough provisions to stop big banks from unfairly squeezing hard-hit homeowners. Apparently, Gensler wanted to keep doing his work at this once obscure agency, staying on guard against financial connivers trying to twist the rules to legalize banker robbery. But Wall Streeters certainly didn't want him there, and Obama bowed to them, displacing the one guy, the one regulatory chief, who had the guts and gumption to stand up to coddle bankers. This is Jim Hightower saying, not only is Gensler gone, but Wall Street now gets a regulator who's being entrusted to return the agency to obscurity. What a disgrace!
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Minimum wage!
You know what it means when they pay you minimum wage? You know what they're trying to tell you? It's like, hey, if I could pay you less, I would.
Yeah! I love that little whipping sound. That's basically what goes on, isn't it? You know, get back to work, you. Get on that treadmill, you. Keep working. Keep going. You'll get that cheese someday. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Thoughts, questions, comments. You know, and I look at this minimum wage thing, and look, I agree with the president when he gave his speech not too long ago saying, you know, this is the fight of our time. You know, this inequality is going to be the legacy of this generation. We are right back to where things were in the good old Gilded days, 114 years ago, when the Pennsylvania Society began saying, hey, let's have our big party so we can show off to each other. We can pimp and preen and say, look what we own and look who we own. And I find it just... And I appreciate Brian sending me the information on the unionized servers, which, understand, huge difference between the unionized servers there at the Waldorf Astoria, who wore the lapel stickers, standing up for workers in Pennsylvania, pushing back against Groves, the Republican Seth Groves, HB 1807, that would deny communities the ability to say workers should have paid vacation or sick time. They should be able to earn some time off. Find that interesting. Because, and then you compare that to the Romney speech, where he was talking about the 47%, you know, those no good nicks who don't pay any federal income tax. Nobody noticed the servers there. If you watch the video, and I watched, you know, really just kind of in horror almost, as you watch this whole video unfold, as people are moving plates and serving water and serving, filling cups and doing all this stuff, the people who are being served, the people who are getting their dishes taken or their glasses filled or any of the things, not even acknowledging the existence of the person doing it. It's just mind-blowing to me. And this idea that, well, $15 an hour is too much. Nonsense. We should have a minimum wage that you can live on. This idea that you work for minimum wage and you're still in poverty is ludicrous. We need to have an economy that provides workers and makes sure that workers have a decent wage, health care, some retirement security, some dignity that if they get sick, they'll be taken care of. If they retire, they'll be taken care of. Something. Because we've got an economy that makes sure that the well-to-do, the folks at the very top, the fat and happy, that they'll never miss a day. They'll never miss a meal. And the numbers, in my view, you know, had you just, and this is an area that I didn't really want to argue with Representative Cohen, because I don't think we really were on the same page. But back in 2006, I said we should have linked it to the inflation index back then so that it would have continued to rise in 2007, 2008, 2009. Well, it would have collapsed in 2009, but it would have gone up as inflation went, and put it against a more accurate inflation index. Don't cherry pick it. Let's not use technology because that's gone down. Had we indexed it to inflation over the years, it would be, I think the number was like somewhere around $11 an hour. Had we indexed it to productivity, had we said as productivity went up, minimum wage would go up too, the minimum wage would be like $21.72. That's the minimum with productivity. And that plays right. This is what the Republicans should be for, honestly and truthfully, tying it to productivity gains. Because, hey, it's meritocracy, right? As your merit goes up, as you produce more, you earn more. That's what they tell us, right? So the minimum wage should be much higher had we just kept it to that. But no, can't do that. Understand, worker productivity has more than doubled since 1968. Now, had the federal minimum wage kept pace with our folks at the very top, those folks at the tippy top, as their wealth has grown percentage-wise, as their wealth has grown, so would yours. You know, sharing in the pie a little bit. The current minimum wage would be 212% higher, somewhere around $22.62 an hour. And they tell us, we don't have any money, which is what I love. I love hearing, wow, it's going to cost us jobs. No, it's not. It's not. And then you get the more ludicrous. Well, if we're going to raise the 50, you might as well raise it to 100. Now you're being ludicrous. I truly believe that the McDonald's and the Walmarts and these huge companies that have built their brand on low wages, on no benefits, on no health care, no pension. And, more importantly, you know, like what I brought up with the representative, on our subsidies. You know, there shouldn't be a taxpayer in this country that doesn't go, no, we want the employers to pay their workers so I don't have to. So that we can use that money that we're subsidizing, the billions of dollars. Understand, every year, according to the National Employment Law Project, every year we, the people, give McDonald's $1.2 billion in public assistance. This is a company that made $1.5 billion in profit last quarter alone. You look at the top 10 fast food companies. Cost we the people almost $4 billion in government health care, in Medicaid. Cost we the people over $1 billion in food assistance. These 10 companies made almost $7.5 billion in profit last year. So to say, well, they didn't have it is ridiculous. Oh, and by the way, you know, the almost $7.5 billion in profits they made, on top of that, they paid out $7.7 billion in dividends to the institutional well-to-do. So you're looking at a profit margin of over $15 billion. So you're telling me that they can't pay their workers a little bit better is ridiculous. Absolutely ludicrous. But, you know, the thing that gets me is that what you have is this institutional messaging that's gone on, that we need to feed these big corporations. They can't exist without our money. They can't exist without low wages. When they're wildly profitable. It's amazing to me. And then you see just the absolute greed at the top. And it doesn't seem to end. I mean, their greed and avarice never seems to be filled. The pocket never full. And I look at this top 10 list put out by the folks over at Too Much Online. They are the weekly online advocate news group of excess and inequality. They've presented their top 10 greediest of 2013. They say butchers and bakers and candlestick makers. You won't find any of them on the annual list of America's most avarice. You will find the wheelers and dealers and the candy store heiress. And they go through the names of 10 folk who, well, very well-to-do. Angela Speca, they call her the pint-sized pilferer. Evidently, she was working with the Los Angeles County, a small group there in Los Angeles County. A very, very small community. I think it was called Bell. And as an assistant city manager over a seven-year span, she ended up taking, in 1 year alone, over $500,000. And by the end of her time, they had taken something like $15.5 million and put it in their pockets. I love the quote from her attorney at her trial who said, "Everyone's greedy." This is her defense. Everyone's greedy. There's no crime in taking too much. Well, maybe not in their world. They go into number 9, Dylan Lauren, the Ralph Lauren fame and fortune and all the money. She decided she was going to start a candy store because she just wanted to live in a world full of candy. Her workers, well, they were protesting her store not too long ago for paying $8.50 an hour with no health care and no pension. The workers wanted some dignity. making $8.50 an hour in Manhattan at this swanky candy bar. The workers, carrying lollipop signs, reading, Dylan, we're not your suckers. And they chanted, Dylan, Dylan, candy queen, you're filthy rich, so share your green. Not going to happen. Number eight, they picked Michael Duke, the former CEO or soon-to-be former CEO of Walmart, who ended up pocketing about $7,000 an hour, which is, almost 800 times what the average Walmart worker makes at $8.86 an hour. Now, understand, the middle of the road, Demos think tank, pointed out that Walmart bought back about $7.6 billion worth of the company's shares that, had they taken and paid workers with, would have raised the lowest wages at Walmart almost $6 an hour. So they absolutely could afford it, according to the middle of the road think tank. Now, he's going to retire this year. He's going to retire with a monthly retirement check of $669,000. Compare that to the average Walmart worker 401k, which will generate about $89 a month. Just makes you think. Number seven is Art Pope. They call him the backroom bully, goes public. A very wealthy person in North Carolina. His parents, started a retail chain. He didn't like having those workers with, anything. So what they needed to do is slash unemployment. They needed to go after, low-wage work. They needed to go after those social programs. So he got himself appointed state budget director. That's what a lot of money will do for you. Put you in those positions of power where he can go and get all of the things that he wants for him and his well-to-do buddies. The last one I'll do here in the first hour is Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, who pocketed almost $150 million last year, because that's his salary. It's what he earns. In fact, he said that Apple has a very strong moral compass, which, if you look at their practices around the world, gotta wonder. Now you've got two former employees who have filed a class action lawsuit to recoup wages lost while standing in line to be searched. Because you don't want people stealing. So on your time, we're going to search you before we let you out of our building. That's America. Sad stuff. Just mind-blowing stuff. When we come back, I'm going to talk about some banking situations. The Volcker Rule, good, bad. All of the talk about, can we hold these big bankers accountable? I don't know. Quick break. Right back.
Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
L&M Hospital in New London, Connecticut has agreed to resume talks Monday to end the lockout of nearly 800 union nurses and healthcare techs. The AFT locals representing the healthcare workers say it's good news for the patients and all people in the region served by the hospital. The union insisted that its entire membership be allowed to sit in on the talks, so a federal mediator will be used to shuttle proposals back and forth between the union and management. The union says the talks are expected to focus on the core issue, the future of patient care delivery at L&M Hospital and its subsidiaries. The Milwaukee Community Coalition, backing the fast food workers movement for $15 an hour and the right to form unions, is behind an effort now to get dozens of fired McDonald's workers reinstated. The workers were abruptly fired with no explanation by the McPiles Corporation, owner of the three McDonald's stores where they worked. The boss is a capitalist pastor known in his military days as Robert McDonald's Piles. He owns at least 11 McDonald's stores in Milwaukee and is senior pastor at Milwaukee's Abundant Faith Church of Integrity. Jennifer Epps Addison is executive director of Wisconsin Jobs Now. She says the community must take a stand to get these workers back to work and demand that Pastor Piles act in accordance with his professed faith to treat these workers justly in this holiday season.
Some of them actually showed up to work and found out that they didn't have a job anymore. This is not what we expect out of any business owner, but certainly not a business owner that's a pastor right before Christmas. This is why people want unions, because the best way to resolve a difficult challenge or even hiring decisions is to sit down across from the people who are making the profits in your stores and to negotiate a fair deal for that. We hope that the union will be able to help Pastor Piles negotiate a fair deal with these workers so that everybody can have a happy holiday season and go into the new year with safe and secure families.
59 locked out Chicago area Teamsters funeral employees have won their unfair labor practices charge against Service Corporation International. The National Labor Relations Board found merit in several of the charges filed by Teamsters Local 727. But Local 727 Secretary Treasurer John Coley says that while thankful the board ruled in the workers' favor, the punishment doesn't fit the crime. Coley says the company's actions have grossly and negatively impacted the workers, and the company deserves a harsher penalty. The company had to acknowledge that they broke the law and notify the workers that they won't do it anymore. SCI has refused the Teamsters' offer for the workers to return to work. The NLRB found that SCI illegally spied on union activity, threatened members with loss of vacation, and unlawfully solicited the workers to withdraw from the union. The workers have been locked out for 5 months.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The men who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Max Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So, back in 2010, you may remember the whole Dodd-Frank thing being passed. We're talking about, hey, how are we going to make sure that the collapse during the Bush years never happens again? A lot of folks like me were saying maybe just, you know, undo what we did that got us into this mess, maybe reinstate Glass-Steagall as the minimum, start thinking about how we update that and make sure that we don't allow banks to become gambling houses. Just a thought. Well, Dodd-Frank's passed. They threw in this idea of the Volcker Rule. Well, here we are, 3 years later. And finally, I guess, a final rule, which is why we've asked Alexis Goldstein, Communication Director at The Other 98%, to come talk to us, theother98.com, to come talk with us. Alexis, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
So here we are, 3 years later, a final rule, yes?
Yes. I can hardly believe it. I thought it was never going to happen. But, yeah. Yes, we have a final rule.
And the final rule, good?
It's a mix. I think that it's much better than the draft. So any new regulation goes through this process where they do a draft, the public gets to comment, and then there's a final rule. So the final rule is definitely stronger in a number of places, but there were also some losses. And then I think there's just a big section of it that's a toss-up, and it's going to depend on whether or not the regulators are going to get tough on the banks. So it's a mix.
I guess it's like any law that you have on the books, it's if it's actually enforced.
Right, exactly. It all comes down to enforcement.
And are we optimistic? Because I got to be honest, I have, when it comes to the banking criminals in this country, I have very honest, and maybe this is just my jaded view on it, but I have very little belief that there will be any real enforcement, especially when you see this swinging door between the Fed and government and the Treasury and Wall Street. Am I just jaded?
No, I think that that's right. And I think that the thing about this rule is it involves five different financial regulators, and some of our financial regulators are stronger than others. And so, you know, to some extent, it's going to depend on what kind of products that people are trading, which regulator is going to be policing them. But the good news is there are some pretty clear standards here, which is basically you don't get to gamble with taxpayer money. And if you want to do a crazy thing that's sort of like the financial equivalent of jumping off of a mountain, you don't get to use the taxpayer as your parachute. But I do think that you're right to be skeptical, and this is going to take Congress, it's going to take the public, kind of watching this really closely. And I think that the easiest thing for us to watch to see whether or not this rule is actually working is the basic idea is banks don't get to do this risky gambling anymore.
Right.
And that's a very particular skill set. So we don't see a bunch of traders leaving these big banks and going to hedge funds in mass. We're going to know that something's not quite right with enforcement.
Okay. And is someone watching that? I'm sure you will be, but...
I will certainly be watching it. So I certainly will report on that. If folks wanted to follow along, there's a sort of a gossipy blog about Wall Street called Deal Breaker. So that's, I suppose, if people wanted to follow along as well. But, yes, I will be watching that very carefully.
Yeah, because you said, you know, we're not going to let banks do all these crazy things. Because for me, I just don't want to see 2008 happen again. I don't want to see any of the big banking scandals we've had, you know, in my lifetime and, you know, in the history of this country. Because we know without doubt, without exception, me and taxpayers like me and you and everybody, we're the ones who end up footing the bill.
Yep. And I think the good news is this isn't a law that exists in a vacuum. There's a bunch of other things that are supposed to work together to prevent that from happening. But this was a really big one, and I do think that the banks are going to have to invest a lot of money into compliance. They're going to have to start compiling metrics.
Oh, geez, no, not job-killing regulations.
Well, right, that's the line. But the good news is, you know, look, reformers are pressing to have those numbers made public to the extent that they can. And I think, look, this is going to change the business of banking. Now, to what extent? I also think that this is an important jumping off point because, look, if you ask me, it sounds like you agree that Glass-Steagall was really the way to go. This was not Glass-Steagall, but it was kind of like a Glass-Steagall light. So what I think it will happen is if, you know, in 6 months' time when this first goes into effect and then maybe a year from today, if we don't see major changes, people like Elizabeth Warren, who has been gung-ho about, no, we need a second Glass-Steagall, are going to have a lot more ammunition, and maybe we can do this in a simpler way going forward. So I think we have maybe a year where we have to wait and see, but, like, this puts a lot of ammunition in the back pocket of reformers who want to go further. Because if this doesn't solve it, that just means we need to take the next step.
Because that was my next question, because I think the idea in Washington and, you know, basically the halls of power is, okay, we did this, we're going to wash our hands, time to move along, old news until the next crisis. Because,
sure.
You know, in looking at this, to me, I'm not a big fan of too big to fail. And here we are at a situation where we're even bigger than we were in 2008 with too big to fail. And this, I don't think does... I should ask the question, does this do anything to limit the size, to make sure that we don't have one bad actor who takes down the whole system? Is there anything like that in this?
The regulators have the ability, if people sort of violate this too many times, to force them to sell off parts of their bank, but it's not really, it's only if you violate it, you know, a bunch of times. This isn't really aimed at shrinking the banks. And
right.
I think that you're absolutely right. We need more legislation that says, that's specifically about shrinking the size. Because, look, it's one thing to say, you can be as big as you want to be, but you just can't do risky gambling. I don't think that's enough. I think we need to say, no risky gambling. We need to say, you need to shrink down. We need to say, you know, you can't, say, you know, participate in certain activities that we think are crazy and should be illegal, like, I don't know, buying insurance on a company that you then talk back about and try to blow up, which is what a credit default swap sometimes, you know, works out to be. It's kind of like buying fire insurance on somebody else's business and then, you know, burning their business down. Right. So I think this is, you know, this is just one step, but it is worth, I think, saying, hey, we did it. You know, we beat back Wall Street. Wall Street wanted to kill this outright. So it's not like, you know, we shouldn't be parading in the streets, but it is a win. And I think it's important to at least, okay, cool. We had one win. Now, how many more wins can we get going forward?
And I guess that's a good way of looking at it. But for me, I this is something that now I don't think there's no appetite really for. But when this happened, I was calling, I said, look, we should be nationalizing the banks, we should be breaking them up and going back to state banking systems, doing something to encourage competition and make sure that if someone fails, you let them fail. Because I got to be honest, I believe in that whole competition model where if you're doing something wrong and you fail, you lose your behind and goodbye.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we really need to take more steps to make sure that the banks are small enough to fail, and right now that's not the case. And I don't know that this will certainly solve that problem, but, you know, look, it's the first step, and I think it actually shows that there is an ability to beat back Wall Street. I think that the draft rule was way worse, And I participated in a comment letter with a group called Occupy the SEC, and we tried to point out all the different loopholes that this rule had. And in the kind of like explanation text that they put out as a supplement to the rule, you know, they cited our letter 284 times. So the word Occupy appears in the explanatory text 284 times, which is kind of crazy. But, you know, reformers had an impact. But you're right. What do we need to do, really? We need to shrink the banks, and this probably won't do that. But there are, it emboldens people that want to do that, right? People like Sherrod Brown and David Vitter, who is a senator that I basically never agree with, but I agree with him on the idea that we should shrink the banks. And so I think that because this is a small win, it gives them more momentum to then take the next step, which is to, okay, how do we shrink the banks down?
Yeah. You know, I go back and Alan Greenspan, statement pops into my head whenever I talk about, you know, 2008 and the whole collapse, that derivatives and those things. He said that they were just such complex financial instruments that the regulators couldn't possibly regulate them, and that they were so technical that only the really, really smart people should be able to do it because government couldn't. And I got to ask the question then, you know, what evolves after this? And I'm sure, and I know you can't answer it, but, you know, it's kind of rhetorical. How do they work around this to where eventually we end up losing again because they've got the power and influence of the money?
Well, I think, you know, they're going to, you know, send their army of lawyers to try and figure out how they weasel around this. And it's going to, you know, be up to the regulators to try and watch that and make sure that they don't do that. But I think that we're at a kind of an important moment right now. I think that it's undeniable that people like Elizabeth Warren are really popular. You see all these articles about, oh, could she give Hillary Clinton a run for her money for the Democratic nomination? And, you know, like Eric Holder got in such hot water for saying that the banks were too big to jail. Like, I just think that we're at a moment where politicians are realizing they at least have to parrot the idea that they're not in the pocket of Wall Street. And I think if we just keep pushing really hard on that, maybe we will get some laws that are not so easy to evade.
That's a good point. They have been, although, too big to jail. I mean, how many of these people who brought the country almost to its knees, how many are behind bars? How many do we lock up? I guess Bernie Madoff was the guy who fell on the sword. I guess him?
I know. It's really unfortunate. The only people they seem to be willing to put in jail are people that do investment fraud. You know, for wealthy people, right? If you rip off a bunch of wealthy people, we'll put you in jail, but that's about it. If you rip off millions of, you know, lower middle income Americans, you get kind of a pass.
Yeah, I mean, if you stole billions of dollars from the pension funds of all the public workers and all the workers in this country, fine,
right.
No problem. We'll just ruin their pensions. But if you take the billionaires' money, they know where to get you.
Yeah. Well, I do think that there's also a sort of light at the end of the tunnel there, too, because I think you can put people in jail, but you can also kind of put a corporation in jail. And the way I think about that is you ban the corporation from doing the thing that makes them money. And there's this regulatory agency no one had really ever heard of before this year called FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and they monitor the electricity market. And J.P. Morgan Chase was manipulating the electricity markets in California, and so they fined them. But then they said, guess what, J.P. Morgan, you don't get to go do trading in electricity for 6 months. So they were not able to make any money doing that for 6 months. And I think that's a really good model to follow. And I, you know, would like to urge all regulators, I don't know how many of them listen to your show, but, you know, that should be their New Year's resolution, that they should treat corporations like they were people. And when they break the law, tell them you don't get to play in this playground anymore, and we're going to ban you from doing the thing that makes you money.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the closest thing we have to corporate prison.
Yeah, and we're going to take the ball and we're going to put it in the sandbox and you're going to have to look at it.
Right, yeah.
But, I mean, to be honest, is that really punishment? I mean, I'm a big fan of punitive punishment in this case. I think flogging isn't good enough for the people who stole, you know, millions of people's pension money and have ruined lives across this country. Just not letting them play in the electric market for 6 months. Just a little anticlimactic, don't you think?
Well, but I think, you know, it's kind of like if you threw one guy in jail, another one would just kind of pop up. Whereas if you just make the whole business freeze for a period of time, that affects everybody.
Yeah.
And so one would hope that the rest of the company would say, you know what, maybe we should stop committing crime. And there's a guy in New York, a guy named Ben Lasky, who's the head of the New York Financial Services regulator, and they banned Deloitte, which is an accounting company, from doing business in New York for a year because they, like, buried the bodies for Standard Chartered, which is a British bank that laundered money and violated all these money laundering laws. So that's a second example of someone that was willing to say, all right, we're going to ban you. So I think you can do both, right?
Yeah, okay.
You put people in jail and you put the corporation in jail.
I'm with you. That's actually, now that you put it that way, I'm in favor of that, but I'm still a fan of flogging. I mean, if there's going to be pain and suffering, it should be felt by the people who've imposed it as well. So in the new year, how long is this going to take to implement? What can we look for? What are the timetables? Just kind of to wrap this up, what are we looking for in the new year then?
So it starts basically in June, and so we're going to be waiting around, I guess, until June. I think Wall Street will probably file some lawsuits to try and challenge this rule because they have more money than, anyone. And so they will challenge everything they can challenge. So in the first 6 months, we'll just watch out for that. And then starting in June, we'll start to see there should begin to be, I think, a flight of, these kind of adrenaline junkie type traders out of the big banks and into hedge funds. And then we'll know that the rule is working. And if not, then let's start talking about Glass-Steagall. Or heck, let's start talking about it now. Why wait?
No, I'm in favor. I've been talking about it since it happened. There has to be that wall of separation. I've got money that I pay my bills with. I've got money that I have fun with. The two of them never commingle.
Right, right.
And our banking system should be no different, because since we have to do everything through kitchen table economics so we can simplify it down to where even I can understand it, that makes pretty good sense.
Sounds good to me.
There you go. Alexis Goldstein, appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Communications director over at the Other 98, other98.com. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents, you may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
The scandalous saga of the Wall Street bailout continues, for bank regulators are now watering down Congress's pathetically weak reforms. However, during the past 4 years, one fellow has shown some regulatory backbone, proposing rules to prevent a repeat of the whole sorry saga. He is Gary Gensler, head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and he's dared to push the Treasury Secretary and other major bank overseers to join him in seriously limiting Wall Street's cavalier proliferation of complex derivatives. Analysts describe these convoluted schemes as poorly disclosed, poorly understood, and could lay waste to the economy. Good for Gensler, right? Yes, but of all the agency heads who are involved in writing new banking rules, guess which one was not invited this year by President Obama to stay on the job? Yes, the tough one, the one actually trying to protect the people, the one not afraid to offend Wall Street greed heads, Gary Gensler. He's being replaced by Timothy Massad, who appears to be more of an industry lapdog than a watchdog. Massad, a career insider, has been a corporate lawyer for banks, a lickspittle lieutenant for Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, himself an infamous Wall Street softie, and a blocker of tough provisions to stop big banks from unfairly squeezing hard-hit homeowners. Apparently, Gensler wanted to keep doing his work at this once obscure agency, staying on guard against financial connivers trying to twist the rules to legalize banker robbery. But Wall Streeters certainly didn't want him there, and Obama bowed to them, displacing the one guy, the one regulatory chief, who had the guts and gumption to stand up to coddle bankers. This is Jim Hightower saying, not only is Gensler gone, but Wall Street now gets a regulator who's being entrusted to return the agency to obscurity. What a disgrace!
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
When you wake up in the morning, do you care about the price of gold?
Well, I pay attention to the price of gold, but I think it reflects a lot of things. It reflects global uncertainties. I think the reason people hold gold is as a protection against what we call tail risk, really, really bad outcomes. And to the extent that the last few years have made people more worried about the potential of a major crisis, then they have gold as a protection.
Do you think gold is money?
No.
It's not money.
Even if it has been money
for 6,000 years, somebody reversed that and eliminated that economic law.
Yes, gold fever. Or lottery fever. Yes, tis the season. Tis the season. 'Twas the night before Mega Millions. Went all through the house. Every creature was scrambling, grabbing cash from even the mouse. The pockets were emptied by the cashier with care in the hopes that their numbers would be there. The families were struggling to make ends meet and to get ahead. But for one brief moment, visions of dollars danced in their head. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen. Come on, Comet and Cupid and Danner and Blitzen. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall. Dash away, dash away. Dash away all. And with them went your dollar. Yes, the mega millions is $550 million. Big drunk. Second largest mega million jackpot pot since its inception, second largest, $550 million annuity. If you win, if you're lucky enough to have the big six all in a row, well, you can get 30 annual payments of whatever 30 divided by 550 million is, or you can have a lump sum of $295.3 million before taxes, of which they'll take, I guess, what, 45%, maybe half. But even at that, I think $147 million, I could live on. Now, am I going to win? No. In fact, I'm not going to win because I'm not going to play. It just seems to be kind of a waste in my view. You've got like a 1 in 500 million chance. Now, since, I guess, Friday there was a drawing of the Mega Million, nobody won, but you had over 500,000 people in Pennsylvania who dropped down their dollar. In fact, they say 563,718. They've got it down to the dollar, to the one number. And people who played the game, who dropped down their dollar, they won $1.176,730. So if you just do kind of the math, that's not even $2 a person. And you gotta say that, you know, I'm sure these people bought 2, 3, 5, 10 tickets because the lottery's not going to be in business if they're losing money. But I look at this, and you know, as I was sitting thinking about this this afternoon, I was remembering the whole push to privatize our lottery and go, you know, why would a for-profit corporation want to take over our lottery? Because, you know, understand, government can't do anything right and, you know, there's no money made in it. Why would they want it? And I keep going, I look at this stuff, I'm going, can you imagine just the if you're taking a small percentage of $550 million to feather your bed? And then, if you listened, and I did, I sat through the hearings that they had on the privatization of the lottery, or running the lottery, they kept talking about, well, we need more people to play, we need to widen the numbers of folks playing. So I Googled, you know, lottery ripoff, and I came across a Forbes magazine article from last year. The title of the article was not just a fairness problem, lotteries warp our minds. And it goes into this whole really very honest look at what the lottery does, especially to the working poor. Because, understand, they came up with a number that people who made less than $13,000 a year dropped an amazing 9% of their income on lottery tickets every year. And you go, and I remember these stories, you know, over the years. I remember one about, I guess it was about 18, 20 years ago, where a homeless family in Florida spent, the guy spent their last $20. He had the wife and three or four kids, I don't remember, living in a station wagon somewhere in Florida in the middle, I think it was the middle of summer, so I can't imagine the sweltering heat, and put down his last $20 to buy a lottery ticket. And, you know, lightning struck the third time, I guess, and this guy won the big jackpot. And everyone was going, wow, that's fantastic. Oh, it's amazing that, you know, that's the reason we have these lotteries. And I'm going, no, that's dumb. I can't imagine, and maybe it's just my way of thinking, but if I'm going to take my last $20, I'm not going to throw it away on playing a lottery when my kids are going hungry. But sadly, our psyche, the thought, the reason they throw these things out there, especially to people making less than $13,000 a year, is, hey, the crummy job you've got ain't going to get any better. Only going to get worse. You're going to keep falling behind. Play the lottery. You got a chance of being a millionaire. You can be one of the 1%. You can be one of them. You can go to the Waldorf Astoria and hobnob with the politicians because you'll have money. And, you know, you stop and you think about, you know, this idea, this, I've got this great opportunity if I just buy this ticket. And I guess that really is the genius that is behind all this. It's that moment of bliss. And I've got friends who were very honest about it. And they were in a financial position where, you know, hey, a buck a day just to keep them, you know, fantasizing about what could be was well worth it. Their kids were fed, their houses were paid, bills were paid, all of that. So, you know, throwing a dollar every once in a while away gave them happy thoughts. Eh, I guess that's okay. Yeah, I can buy a yacht, I can go fishing every day, whatever. But the problem is, you know, you're going after this market where that's your only option. That's your retirement. I had a friend of mine who said that's his retirement plan. Since where he worked had no retirement, and he didn't make enough where he could actually save on his own, so he would take a dollar every now and again and play the big jackpots in the hope that, hey, I can have a pension. And that's what, you know, that's the thing that gets me. And what it does is you get addicted to that feeling, you get addicted to that thought that, hey, you know, this cumulative psychological cost of buying and hoping and the letdown and then doing it again and again and again is kind of, you know, how they've made their money. And the other part of it for me is, and they pitch it to us as, well, you know, we're funding education with the lottery. We're funding programs for older Pennsylvanians. Or we're doing such good with the money that we're basically taking from the poor and funneling it through, and maybe they get a little bit of it back. I guess the other thing that caught my attention in the hearing was the CEO woman of Camelot Global, the company that wanted to take over the administrative part, the management part of the lottery, that she said in the UK, where they manage one of the lottery systems there, that it's used for, you know, things like the Olympics, it's used for arts and humanities, and it's used for extra stuff, for you know, what you would call kind of high-minded stuff. And looking at Maslow's hierarchy, closer to the top, to self-attainment, to that better self ideal. Here we're using it for core basic functions like education and healthcare and caring for our most vulnerable and caring for you know, our future. Instead of saying we're going to invest in those things as a matter of course, no, we've got to have gambling where we take the broken dreams and the broken hopes and view of the future and manipulate it so that people play the damn game. And that's how we fund this stuff. It's kind of interesting. And yet you get hooked to it day after day. So I won't be buying a ticket. Maybe you will be, but I won't be. I'm more of an idea. I'll take my dollar, I'll invest it. Or to have more fun, since if you're going to do it for fun, I like the idea of just going up at the top of a tall building and dropping a dollar out the window and watching people scurry for it. I think that would be a little more fun than watching my number not come up. Anyway, going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Spare a moment for the homeless or the poor. Who cares about the deficit? We want a glorious war. Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
L&M Hospital in New London, Connecticut has agreed to resume talks Monday to end the lockout of nearly 800 union nurses and healthcare techs. The AFT locals representing the healthcare workers say it's good news for the patients and all people in the region served by the hospital. The union insisted that its entire membership be allowed to sit in on the talks, so a federal mediator will be used to shuttle proposals back and forth between the union and management. The union says the talks are expected to focus on the core issue, the future of patient care delivery at L&M Hospital and its subsidiaries. The Milwaukee Community Coalition, backing the fast food workers movement for $15 an hour and the right to form unions, is behind an effort now to get dozens of fired McDonald's workers reinstated. The workers were abruptly fired with no explanation by the McPiles Corporation, owner of the three McDonald's stores where they worked. The boss is a capitalist pastor known in his military days as Robert McDonald's Piles. He owns at least 11 McDonald's stores in Milwaukee and is senior pastor at Milwaukee's Abundant Faith Church of Integrity. Jennifer Epps Addison is executive director of Wisconsin Jobs Now. She says the community must take a stand to get these workers back to work and demand that Pastor Piles act in accordance with his professed faith to treat these workers justly in this holiday season.
Some of them actually showed up to work and found out that they didn't have a job anymore. This is not what we expect out of any business owner, but certainly not a business owner that's a pastor right before Christmas. This is why people want unions, because the best way to resolve a difficult challenge or even hiring decisions is to sit down across from the people who are making the profits in your stores and to negotiate a fair deal for that. We hope that the union will be able to help Pastor Piles negotiate a fair deal with these workers so that everybody can have a happy holiday season and go into the new year with safe and secure families.
59 locked out Chicago area Teamsters funeral employees have won their unfair labor practices charge against Service Corporation International. The National Labor Relations Board found merit in several of the charges filed by Teamsters Local 727. But Local 727 Secretary Treasurer John Coley says that while thankful the board ruled in the workers' favor, the punishment doesn't fit the crime. Coley says the company's actions have grossly and negatively impacted the workers, and the company deserves a harsher penalty. The company had to acknowledge that they broke the law and notify the workers that they won't do it anymore. SCI has refused the Teamsters' offer for the workers to return to work. The NLRB found that SCI illegally spied on union activity, threatened members with loss of vacation, and unlawfully solicited the workers to withdraw from the union. The workers have been locked out for 5 months.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I'm passionate about our economic liberty because I have witnessed our free enterprise system as it rewards the hard work of many and creates prosperity for all in this great country.
The snipers in windows taking a peek. No people panic running scared through the streets. I didn't see anybody without arms, legs, or feet. Pretty good day.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Our tweet of the day comes from a North Carolina state senator, Republican Bob Rucco, who on Sunday tweeted out, Justice Roberts Penn and Obamacare has done more damage to the United States than the swords of the Nazis, Soviets, and terrorists combined. And that's more of the, you know, the Republican view that Obamacare is going to destroy the world. Heaven forbid we get health care to folks. We're here to talk about his book, Grassroots Advocacy and Health Care Reform, The H-CAN campaign in Pennsylvania's Mark Steer. Mark, thanks for taking time for us. Oh, I guess he's not here. We kind of lost him. But no, I look at this, and the preaching has been Obamacare is the end of the world. And I've heard this time and time again. The end of the world. Civilization is going to cease to exist because, well, we're getting people health care. Anyway, here to talk about the new book is Mark Steer. The book, of course, is Grassroots Advocacy and Healthcare Reform, the H-CAN Campaign in Pennsylvania. Mark, thanks for taking time for us.
Pleasure to be back talking to you, Rick.
Yeah. So you've got this frame out here that the healthcare law, the Obamacare, the end of the world. In fact, this guy from North Carolina says that Obamacare is going to do more damage than the swords of Nazis, Soviets, and terrorists combined.
I know. What can you say? The right has gone crazy. They don't make sense to anyone but themselves these days.
So what made you write the book? Why?
Well, you know what? I was an academic, as you know, before I became an organizer, and I thought I had a pretty unique set of experiences. I have a training in political science. I studied American politics, and I had this experience being part of, you know, really what was the biggest issue advocacy in American history, and running what, no great thanks to me, was widely thought to be the strongest state H-CAN campaign in the 43 states where their campaign was in effect. And I thought, you know, it'd be useful for organizers and for citizens and for political scientists to get this perspective of someone who did the on-the-ground organizing but can think about it a little bit from a broad perspective about. And that's why I did it. And the most important thing is I want people to know that organizing makes the difference and what effective organizing looks like.
And especially at a time when, you know, over the last 30 years, we've been told it's all about the individual and we don't need each other. I think more than ever, we need that kind of organization, that organizing that's going to bring people together into broad-based coalitions where even if we don't agree on everything, there are things that we can agree on.
Yeah, I think that's the most important thing. Not everyone in the H-CAN coalition agreed, and not all of us are equally as happy with where we got, although I think most of us, it's a major first step. And, you know, some of the people who were key in the coalition, AFL-CIO, they wanted single payer, but they didn't think they could get it, so they wanted to go with us. United Student Commercial Workers, SEIU, they had different ideas about what the ultimate goal is, but they put them aside. And, you know, even some of the unions who were officially part of H-CAN, the steel workers in particular, they were there at the end fighting right alongside us. And, you know, some of my best friends from the H-CAN campaign weren't even officially part of it, but they worked with us just the same. And it was a great labor coalition, a community coalition, you know, Action United, Philadelphia Unemployment Project, Penn Action, all of them came to Keystone Progress, all came together.
Yeah, but I think here again, you're talking about something that I think the majority of people wanted. People wanted to make sure that they had access to health care, affordable, quality health care, that when they got sick, they don't go bankrupt. And I still think, you know, for all of the it's worse than, you know, we got death panels and it's worse than Hitler and Stalin, for all of that rhetoric and all of that vitriol, I still think people at their core believe that everyone should have access to health care.
Yeah, it's true. Everyone did believe that. The majority still believes that. But unless you're willing to take a step and be active about it, it's not effective. And it's not just enough to post on Facebook or talk to your friends. You've got to come out and take it to the street. And let me give you an example about it, because everyone's worried about the right wing. We beat back the right wing. You know, in August 2009, that's when the Tea Party raised its ugly head. I was there in the Constitution Center the first time they went totally crazy at an event. But you know what? In late August and September, we outgunned the Tea Party in 40 out of 44 congressional events. The Tea Party folks came out. They thought they were going to be the ones to push these members of Congress against the ACA, that they were speaking for the people. And they found out they were outnumbered and that there were lots of people, local constituents, who could tell Congressman Carney and Congressman Dow Kemper and Congressman Pomjorski, Congressman Murphy, that they wanted health care reform. Now, if we hadn't organized, all those members of Congress would have just heard from the other side.
Right.
And they were paid. You know, they had a big expensive campaign that the Koch brothers were paying for.
Yeah, and, you know, I've often said that, you know, the Koch brothers can, they've got, they can outspend us, but we've out-procreated them. And if we can organize and we can get, as you pointed out, if we can get into the streets and into these meetings and all of that, we've got at least a fighting shot.
That's right. And I'm, so that's what the book is about. One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to name as many people as I could. And I probably named 300 or 400 people, and I didn't even get to all of them. Because they should go down in history as the people who made this happen. You know, everyone has to say, oh, Obama's going to pass health care with our help. I think the truth is we passed health care with Obama's help.
So let me ask you with that frame, because I believe that frame wholly. I believe that all of the reforms that happen are not because of benevolent politicians who say we're going to do this for you, but because the people in mass push them in that direction. But do you think that, in looking at that, because I got to be honest, I'm one that has not been overly thrilled with what the ACA has been yet. Maybe I will be in a couple years, and maybe this idea of incremental change, things will improve over time. I'm hoping that to be the case. But do you think that, you know, some of that, you know, the push would have been to more quicker, and maybe some of the people who we've used slowed the process a little bit, if that makes sense to you?
No, I think we got everything we could. I mean, there are a couple of things that if they had gone a little bit differently, we would have gotten the House bill instead of the Senate bill. I think if Harry Reid had really understood that the filibuster, you know, was being abused, he would have used reconciliation, and we could have gotten the House bill, or something closer to it, maybe even the public option. But you know what? The health care is a scary thing, and that's the reason that the Tea Party is so effective. People take this very personally, and they're really scared by change. And this is one area where incremental reform made a difference. The trick was to find a reform that sets us on a path to further reform. And you know what? If the subsidies aren't good enough, that will build a movement itself to make those subsidies better. If there's not enough competition, that'll create a movement to create a public option. And, you know, California has a public option, one-eighth of the country, and we'll see that they get better health care because of it. So, you know, the ACA was certainly not perfect. It's not my ideal, but it sets in motion a lot of political forces. Hopefully it will get us much closer to we all want.
Yeah, I mean, that's my hope. My hope is that as things pop up, that you go, okay, this isn't working quite so well, that we do get a movement to like Medicare. I mean, I go back and you read the history of Medicare, and I'm hoping this follows the same path. And I've used the John Kennedy quote where he says, you know, in 30 years, I hope people will look back at Medicare and go, how'd we ever live without it? I'm hoping that down the road, you hear the same kind of thing about this.
Yeah, I think we will. And you know what? And we got to keep organized to do it. It's not just going to happen. We have to organize, and we have to work in partnership with our political leaders. It really was a partnership. The political leadership of the House and Senate, our leaders in Pennsylvania, Congressman Schwartz and Patan and Brady, they worked hand in glove with us. They were champions for it, but they helped build the movement. Our movement helped them do what they did in Congress. And that's really what we need. And sometimes I think we think that organizing means, you know, beating up on our members of Congress. A lot of times, sometimes it does. Sometimes it's necessary. Sometimes it's really forming a partnership with.
Yeah, I mean, well, at the end of the day, they're supposedly to do the work of we the people.
Mm-hmm.
So when we say this is what we want, doesn't it stand to reason that that's what they should be doing?
Yeah, and not all of them will, but a lot of them do. And the more we talk with them and work with them and show them that we can build the support they need to do tough things, like pass this difficult piece of legislation, the more emboldened they are to do the hard work.
And, you know, this, when I look at this as, you know, kind of a blueprint for a lot of the other things that we need to be doing, in my view, raising the minimum wage, an economy that works for everybody, that if you work, you don't have to live in poverty, maybe some talk about increasing Social Security, not shrinking it, but actually expanding it. A lot of this stuff, I think, all works hand in hand, where the kind of advocacy and the kind of organizing you're talking about in your book is something that not just healthcare reform, but all movements forwards for working people.
Yeah, I think there's no question that when I talk to people in D.C. who are thinking about, you know, the next Democratic president, what they're going to do, they're also thinking about what do we have to build now so that we can push them and support them in moving in the right direction. And when people think about the model, they all look at is HCAN. And that's part of the reason I wrote the book. There are other books that talk about how HCAN works nationally as a whole, but I thought if we focused just on one state, people would see what the real grassroots organizing looked like and how it was done. Because, frankly, a lot of people in Washington don't get grassroots politics, you know. And I wanted to make sure that they understood what we did. Yeah. It wasn't just sending people to the states. It was helping the people who were already organized in the states work together and giving them the resources, tools they need to do a better job.
And talking to your neighbors. I mean, the basis of organizing is organizing the people that you know and the people that are around you and expanding. You know, someone told me, well, you're just singing to the choir. And I go, yeah, but I'd like to make my congregation a little bit bigger, which is why you talk to friends and neighbors and do that grassroots stuff.
Yeah, it was an intensely local thing. We had people all over the state. Now, we also had organizers, and I think at this point, with everyone's busy lives, you need resources to... And I had an incredibly great staff from HCAN, great staff people lent to us by the unions, and they were critical to it. But ultimately, what they did was help people organize themselves. We had 25,000 people around the state who at one time or another took part in an HCAN event.
Wow. Now, that's pretty impressive. Now, if you could only do that to a lot of the other things that we need to get done, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, I think that... This really is the model, and there's a lot that can be accomplished. You name the big ones, minimum wage, the Social Security expansion, reviving our public sector and creating more public sector jobs with the living wages. That's the kind of stuff that is only going to happen if we organize in the same level of same scale and level of intensity.
Yeah, say public education, all of that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The book is Grassroots Advocacy and Healthcare Reform, the HCAN Campaign in Pennsylvania, written by Mark Steer. You can pick it up at Amazon. I guess right now just the Kindle version?
Yeah, actually, no, it's in press in a hardback. Here's the thing. I was thinking I was going back into academia, so it's an academic publisher. It's ridiculously expensive. It's $90. If someone wants a copy at half price, you can get it for them, for anyone listening to this show. They can email me, and I think you can put up that link at your website. It's
yep.
marksteer@steer.net. And the other thing is, I actually I got to organize to get people to tell the publisher they want to read it in an affordable paperback. So I'm putting up a little petition on my blog, blog.steer.net. And if you want to read the book at $20, which is what it should cost for a decent paperback, sign up there. And if I get 200 people say they want it, we'll talk the publisher to coming out with a paperback version sometime next year.
And we will make sure that we get a link at thericksmithshow.com and all over our Facebook and all of that to make sure people have access to it. Mark, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time, and keep up the great work.
Thanks very much for you, too. Your show does an enormous service for the state. I hope everyone appreciates it.
I appreciate it, Mark. Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
This holiday season, try buying a gift that can really make a difference in someone else's life. Buy your friend, family member, or coworker a goat and help fight hunger in South Sudan. To do so, visit goatsfortheoldgoat.com. There you can buy a goat and also shop for beautiful merchandise made by actual women from South Sudan. One click of a button this holiday season could mean the difference between nourishment and hunger for people who often go days without eating. Goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Again, that's goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
For many, the eight-hour day is the standard, but it wasn't always this way. The original American workday was from sunup to sundown, following the demands of an agricultural workday. Over time, the nation became more industrialized, and workers moved from individually owned, self-sufficient farms to factories, taking workers from their homes and families. Factory owners demanded the agricultural sunup to sundown workday, forcing workers to toil long hours in grueling conditions. Workers began to collectively organize in pursuit of more time for family, education, and recreation. The cry of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will grew louder. For a century, the eight-hour day was viewed as the holy grail of the labor movement, and for this hallowed vision, workers sacrificed, often with their blood and their lives. The first strike for shorter hours occurred in May of 1791 in the city of Philadelphia, where carpenters protested a day's wages, paying the same in January as was paid for a longer day in July. Chicago in 1886 was home to one of the largest showings of solidarity. Some 80,000 workers turned out to support the eight-hour cause. It was in Chicago's Haymarket Square that a terrorist bomb and the blazing guns of company-paid police cost policemen and numerous workers their lives and their blood. As a result of the Haymarket tragedy, eight innocent men were tried and convicted for a crime they did not commit. Four of the men were hung. The Haymarket Square tragedy was but one of many battles in which working men, women, and children shed blood, tears, and flesh in the pursuit of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, and 8 hours for what we will. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Trough you stop to feed with your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So good news. Evidently, I guess we're going to be privatizing substitute teachers now. I was looking at this report, and I guess it's going to be decided tonight whether the Central Dauphin School District is going to privatize the substitute teachers. I guess they're going to hire somebody from New Jersey to recruit, hire, and schedule substitutes for the district, and well, because you know it's so difficult, I guess. And you know, I look at this and I go, are we losing control of all in the name of cost cutting? And you know, in talking with Mark there a second ago, one of the big things for me that's got to be going on is the organizing to take back public education, to take back that opportunity for kids in the future, and take it away from ideologues, the privateers, the people who say, well, we don't need the school districts hiring teachers, and the substitutes. You know, for me, I always thought the substitutes, that's how you got into being, you know, a regular teacher. You know, you got some experience. You were bouncing around until a job, something opened up, and you slid right into the. No, I guess not anymore. Now it's like, well, it's like temp work. It's like low wage factory work now. But that's kind of what they're turning education into. And I came across this article that the religious right in this country has done a masterful job of organizing, of taking education where they want it. And it's not where they want it is not education. What they want is they want religious conversion. They want religious ideologues. And not all that educated either. So this guy's name's Johnny Sacamanga. He wrote a piece over at Alternet that took a look at this ACE curriculum. They have a standardized test, and they have a bunch of them, this accelerated Christian education curriculum that evidently is used in more than 6,000 schools across the country and in hundreds of and thousands of these homeschooled school kids, you know, homes or whatever, in over 140 countries. And your tax dollars go to pay for it. The voucher program in a number of states actually pays for this stuff. And, you know, he goes into, you know, you look at this whole push towards this fundamentalism where we have our beliefs and nothing else should matter. And, you know, he says that while he went through one of these ACE kind of schools, that, you know, he writes, quote, by the time I left, I was certain that it was against God's will for governments to provide health care. Evolution was a conspiracy to destroy Christianity, and parents were morally required to spank their children, and science could prove that homosexuality was wrong. You know, all of these things that, you know, yeah, okay. And you've got to pass the test, as well as make sure that you're in line. So he went through and he looked at a number of tests and picked out, you know, questions that he found very interesting. Like for fourth grade tests, they wanted the definition of wisdom. And they said the pastor spoke with great wisdom. Wisdom means A, a test, B, godly thinking, or C, tasty milk. And then just think about that. I mean, there can only be, in their vision, one actual answer. Speaking with great test? No. Speaking with tasty milk? No, but it's what they believe. Scale drawing. Father made a scale drawing of our house. Question number two. Scale drawing means a small picture. B, fish skin. C, a tent. Huh. Celsius, they wanted the definition for that. The temperature reading was a Celsius reading. Celsius is a certain Bible, the metric temperature scale. And, you know, I got to be honest, when I read that, I go, well, in the fundamentalist world, it would be a certain Bible. But no, it's the other one. The word plunger, he said, the question asked, the plunger in the pump was broken. Plunger means a dolphin, a pump part, or a brown car. And I'm going, wait a second. Did I miss something here? I thought the idea was, never mind. Another fourth grade question. Some special men have used the cookies, knowledge, classes. God gave them to discover more about our wonderful world. And, of course, God gave us cookies, right? Or at least apples. And, you know, he goes through all of these really just bizarre questions that you go, this is what we're paying for? And he points out that, you know, this kind of ACE education is about regurgitation. It's about conformity. It's about these are your sets of beliefs, and this is what you must conform to. And I'm telling you, I want critical thinkers. I want people who are going to see a problem and figure out how to fix that problem. I don't want a society full of people who stand in the same line and wear the same shoes and think the same way and understand only what's been presented to them. I want my kids to be thinkers, not ideologues. And I'm telling you, we got to organize around that. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the very well-to-do and finish up the top 10 list and some other things along the way. Quick break, right back.
Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
L&M Hospital in New London, Connecticut has agreed to resume talks Monday to end the lockout of nearly 800 union nurses and healthcare techs. The AFT locals representing the healthcare workers say it's good news for the patients and all people in the region served by the hospital. The union insisted that its entire membership be allowed to sit in on the talks, so a federal mediator will be used to shuttle proposals back and forth between the union and management. The union says the talks are expected to focus on the core issue, the future of patient care delivery at L&M Hospital and its subsidiaries.
The Milwaukee Community Coalition, backing the fast food workers movement for $15 an hour and the right to form unions, is behind an effort now to get dozens of fired McDonald's workers reinstated. The workers were abruptly fired with no explanation by the McPiles Corporation, owner of the three McDonald's stores where they worked. The boss is a capitalist pastor known in his military days as Robert McDonald's Piles. He owns at least 11 McDonald's stores in Milwaukee and is senior pastor at Milwaukee's Abundant Faith Church of Integrity. Jennifer Epps Addison is executive director of Wisconsin Jobs Now. She says the community must take a stand to get these workers back to work and demand that Pastor Piles act in accordance with his professed faith to treat these workers justly in this holiday season.
Some of them actually showed up to work and found out that they didn't have a job anymore. This is not what we expect out of any business owner, but certainly not a business owner that's a pastor right before Christmas. This is why people want unions, because the best way to resolve a difficult challenge or even hiring decisions is to sit down across from the people who are making the profits in your stores and to negotiate a fair deal for that. We hope that the union will be able to help Pastor Piles negotiate a fair deal with these workers so that everybody can have a happy holiday season and go into the new year with safe and secure families.
59 locked out Chicago area Teamsters funeral employees have won their unfair labor practices charge against Service Corporation International. The National Labor Relations Board found merit in several of the charges filed by Teamsters Local 727. But Local 727 Secretary Treasurer John Coley says that while thankful the board ruled in the workers' favor, the punishment doesn't fit the crime. Coley says the company's actions have grossly and negatively impacted the workers, and the company deserves a harsher penalty. The company had to acknowledge that they broke the law and notify the workers that they won't do it anymore. SCI has refused the Teamsters' offer for the workers to return to work. The NLRB found that SCI illegally spied on union activity, threatened members with loss of vacation, and unlawfully solicited the workers to withdraw from the union. The workers have been locked out for 5 months. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So on Thursday, last Thursday, the Family Act was introduced by New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and Connecticut Representative Rosa DeLauro. The idea is something I've been talking about for years. With this being the 20th anniversary year of the passage of the Family Medical Leave Act, it's always blown my mind that there was no pay component in this. So even if you needed one of these things, you needed to take time off for an illness or a sick parent or the birth of a child, as I was fortunate enough to do three times over the years. What if you couldn't afford it? What if you didn't have the money to be able to say, you know what, I'm going to take 5-6 weeks off. I'm going to take 12 weeks off to welcome my newborn into the world. You shouldn't have the money. I've always thought if you really want to talk about family values, let's make sure that there's a way that all families get access to it, which is why I'm happy to see the Family Act introduced. And here to talk a little bit about it, I got Jenny Cassidy. She's the director of California Work and Family Coalition, the manager of the Children and Families Program at Next Generation. Jenny, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you.
So here we are, 20 years after Clinton signed the Family Medical Leave Act, and here in Pennsylvania, no pay component. I understand in California, they were the first state in the country who back in 2002 passed the paid family leave program.
Yeah, we were the first state to pass it, and now we're on our 10th anniversary next year.
So
it's been a while.
So, of course, it must have killed millions of jobs, and everybody must be unemployed because of this onerous regulation and this rule that's just a job killer. No, not so much.
No. There's been a great study on it that showed it wasn't a job killer at all, and that it really benefited families. Breastfeeding rates have than ever before. Family leave was passed in the state.
Wow, and so there must be a whole bunch of freeloaders on the system, right?
No, in fact, we think one of our jobs as a coalition is to increase take-up, because one of our problems is that not enough people know about it, there wasn't an advertising component when we passed the law, so we learned you need to do something to educate people. We want more people to take it. The fund is really healthy.
Absolutely. And you know, I look at this and I go, you know, I hear people of a certain political persuasion talk about how much they love the family and they love the children. It's all about the children. And how, you know, they preach family values, and preach is about all they do. But there's a lot of rhetoric around it. Yet when something like this comes up, or a pay component back in 93 when Clinton signed it, they were dead set against it and would fight tooth and nail against something that I think is truly a piece of legislation that would give someone the ability to say they believe in family values.
Yeah, I mean, we're the only country that has maternity leave. I mean, we don't even have guaranteed job protection for everybody. Even FMLA doesn't cover everyone. And then we don't have paid maternity leave in this country, or caregiving leave in most countries. 98% of countries in the world have that. It's something that's just so basic, people don't even think of it. And a lot of, you know, California has a high population of new immigrants. My kid's school has a lot of new immigrants. And when they have their second baby and they're having that baby here, they're shocked that they don't have, there's no right to maternity leave and no pay, which, of course, for lower income families, you know, it's practically impossible to take that kind of time off without having some kind of wage replacement.
Yeah, I got to be honest with you. When my children were born, and look, I've always been fortunate enough to have a good paying union job. But the reality is when I took those 7-8 weeks with each of my kids, it was a financial burden that I don't think, you know, I want families to have to struggle, especially when you're starting out, especially when you've got young children that you need to be able to support.
Yeah, it's a real issue of economic security. That's why, you know, we're in our coalition. We're part of the National Family Values at Work. It has 21 different state coalitions. And we look at paid sick days, paid family leave as a really crucial part of just being economically secure. So whatever your wages are, the idea that you have to go without them the minute your child is sick or you're sick, or you need to take leave to have a new baby, is just ridiculous. And people, it makes it such a weird inequality where only people with money, or, you know, the small percentage of people can even afford to take time off to be with a new baby.
Well, you know, we're in the company of really economic giants when it comes to our position on paid leave. We're in the company of Swaziland and Papua New Guinea as the only places on the earth that doesn't have some type of paid leave, which I think speaks volumes.
Yeah, it really does. It's pretty ridiculous that so many people don't have this basic right. But I think right now there's a lot of momentum. States around the country have been working on their own paid leave laws around paid sick days, and it's a great time to have this at the national level because it's pushing the conversation. Even if it takes a while to pass the actual federal legislation, it's really created a splash, and I'm glad people are talking about it.
Yep.
And it just feels so much more possible now than ever before, I think.
Yeah, I mean, people are talking about it. And I've heard communities around the state of Pennsylvania, actually, you know, Philadelphia was actually going to pass a paid sick day ordinance, which is why the Republicans here in our General Assembly have put forth House Bill 1807, which would make it illegal for local governments and local townships and municipalities to have ordinances that would force, you know, these poor companies who just, you know, would be crushed, just absolutely crushed, from giving letting their employees earn sick time off.
Yeah, I know that's happening all over the country. The preemption bills where they're trying to stop paid sick days because they see that it has legs, it has momentum. You know, in New York, a lot of people think that de Blasio won because of the other candidate taking a big stand against having the vote for paid sick days. And that was huge for us because it means that people really want this and people are very angry. And I think that, you know, the other side is kind of seeing that and pushing it. And that's why I think the unions are really key in this. And we need, I mean, in California, we would never have passed paid leave without our statewide labor movement. And part of why we could do this before some other states is that we had, relatively speaking, a stronger union movement. And unions can also enforce it once we pass something like this. They can help us make sure that
it's
people
in their
can
contracts.
Benefit from it.
Yeah, it's in their contracts and it's enforceable.
Yeah.
Which is why, John, we have to destroy unions. See, didn't you get the memo? Didn't you get the Alec memo? Because Alec, you know, Alec's behind this American Legislative Exchange Council, behind this preemptive strike, making sure that local communities, because, you know, those local governments, you don't know what those crazy people are going to do, like minimum wage and health care and all that stuff. So we have to take that away. It's also, you know, destroy those unions because heaven forbid people earn a decent living. Heaven forbid people get health care or retirement security. Can't have that.
Yep, or the regular middle class or poor people can put their families first. It's like upper class people. Just ridiculous,
right? Yeah, we're so much happier in the company of Swaziland and Papua New Guinea.
Yeah. No, I'm really excited about it because here, you know, we have had such a great benefit from it that it'll make a big difference if we're doing this around the country.
Yes.
And in California, we have this, you know, statewide movement, and we really want to push for the Family Act, and we're also trying to improve our law. We just passed a law this year, actually, again, with the help of our labor movement, of course, and our caregivers and parents to extend our paid leave to other family members. So now you can take it to care for a sibling, grandparent, grandchild, or parent-in-law.
Fantastic.
And that's really important here because people don't really just have the classic family members that are covered by FMLA. We have pretty diverse families, a really high rate of people living in multi-generation households, also a high rate of single people, and it's their siblings to care for them when they have cancer or need to go to multiple doctor's appointments and they have a serious health condition. We have a super high rate of siblings being the main caregiver, so we are extending that paid family leave to those family members starting July 1st here in California.
And to me, you know, again, you know, you talk about that family values thing, and I don't care how you define your family. And there are a lot of different ways of doing that. I think that, you know, if you're caring for someone, you know, in your unit, I think there should be some component of making sure, do it through unemployment, do it through whatever, but to make sure that that you can do that. So in looking at this, because I want to bring it back to the Family Act, the Family and Medical Insurance Leave Act that was put forth last Thursday by Democratic Senator Kristen Gildebrand and Democratic Representative Rosa DeLauro. What are the bones of this? I mean, where's the money coming from? How's this going to work? Who's covered? Thoughts like that.
Well, it's a great plan. Okay, so if the way the law is written now, it would be 12 weeks of paid leave. In California and some of the other states that have it, we have 6 weeks, not 12. So it would be 12 weeks, the same amount of time that FMLA covers of paid leave at 66% of your income, and that would have a capped maximum at $4,000. And then it has a minimum, too, at $580 a week. So that's the basic bones of it. And then it comes not straight out of Social Security, but within the Social Security Fund, which has an infrastructure, there would be a new trust fund. It's both employer and employee paid. So both are contributing to it for the health of everybody, right, which is the ideal. And so everybody contributes to it. It would cover a lot more workers now because it would be people who pay into Social Security. And I'm not sure exactly if people don't pay into it, if they would be able to pay into this trust fund because some of the details of this are being worked out. But
it hasn't been hashed out.
It will cover a lot more people, and it will be a lot more money than existing laws in the three states that have paid leave. So it will be a real improvement on, you know, even for the states that have it, it will be a really good thing.
They're saying that the average contribution from workers in the country would be about $2 a week.
Yeah, it's really small. And, you know, it would cover a lot more people. It will cover the same people that FMLA covers. That's your spouse, your parents, your child.
And then maybe we can do some organizing to expand that a little bit.
Yeah, probably. And also right now, you know, people are thinking this could take up to 5 years to pass, but so there's a lot of momentum and a lot of – it was the first meeting where people came together to launch this before it actually got introduced. It was a hugely diverse, massive group of people from all over the country. So it seems like it's really – you know, there's a lot of different organizations and groups giving input, human rights groups, unions, parent and caregiver groups. So there's a lot of there's still sort of some input back and forth, but people are really happy with what it says.
Yeah.
Going to be a very comprehensive.
because one of my questions was, you know, in, given the divided nature of our Congress, given the do nothing, the true not, do nothing Congress that we have, is this possible in this legislative term, or is this piece of legislation put forth as a hey, let's set the goalpost somewhere and give us somewhere to work towards? So, but you've already answered that it's a 5-year plan, right?
Well, me saying that. I think that's kind of the reality and what people are saying. But, you know, these things have been, things like this have been introduced before with very little fanfare. And the reason this is different is the momentum around the country. The women senators, the women in Congress are really ready to push this women's economic agenda to look at how, you know, it's not just for women, obviously, but women are still the vast majority of caregivers. Women suffer poverty at a higher rate, partly because of how we're paid compared to men, but also partly because we're the caregivers and we take time off work to have children, to care for the children, even to care for elders. So there's a lot of attention right now coming from all sides to solve this issue once and for all. And I think the momentum's going to grow and the conversation's going to be out there, even if it doesn't pass right away. It's a lot different than anything else that's been introduced similarly because people are really fed up and people are angry. They know that it's even more popular than, I don't remember what it's more popular than, but I was in a meeting and it was more popular than something really popular. It's just, you know, people care more almost about, oh, even more than paid sick days, people want this, which was surprising to me. It's just got a lot of momentum and people are really willing to push for it.
Right.
And California, we're pushing for it and we even already have it. And I couldn't believe how excited coalition members are about working on this year.
Yeah, I saw a National Partnership for Women and Families poll. That said,
yeah,
nearly 90% of the voters that they surveyed said it was important for their leaders to consider this paid component of the Family Medical Leave Act, and 2 out of 3 considered it very important. So you have,
yeah,
this is one of those issues that the people are well ahead of the of the people in office, and this to me is a campaign kind of issue. Because
oh, yeah,
if you're going to put yourself out as I'm a family values guy, this is family values.
Oh yeah, it'll hurt people that come out against it. It's going to be it'll definitely be an election issue in the state, in the country. This is, I think people are really primed on this issue right now, and it's going to make people look bad if they come out against it.
Yeah, well, I'm with you, and it's, in my view, it's 20 years too late.
Yes.
in the making. It's something that should have been part of it from the beginning. But sadly, for those who remember the 93 fight over it, that was the first thing that got thrown out. Oh, no, you can have your little time off, but no money for you.
Yeah. It's sad. I mean, Clinton says it was, of all the legislation he passed, people thanked him for this more than anything else. I mean, it's definitely so important. And imagine if it had been paid, what a different country this could be right now.
No, absolutely.
It makes a huge difference.
As someone who's used it 4 times, because you know, I had a family member who was ill and ended up having to spend a lot of time with that. And I was able to use it incrementally, taking days here and there for doctor's appointments and stuff. Again, because I had a union job where my contract actually backed me up. I'm sure they'd have fired me. I'm sure they would have fired me long before it got to any part of complaints. But as someone who's used it a number of times, I see the value in it. And as someone who said, you know, I could have used the money, I see even more of the value of having it paid. For me, true family values. So let's, as this continues, I'd love to have you back, but we need to keep pushing this issue. And I really appreciate you taking time for us.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much, Jenny Cassidy, Director of the California Work and Family Coalition, also the Manager Children and Families Program at Next Generation. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Should we be paying people to take care of their children and when they take time off? I think so, yes. Your thoughts right back.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but know, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
The scandalous saga of the Wall Street bailout continues, for bank regulators are now watering down Congress's pathetically weak reforms. However, during the past 4 years, one fellow has shown some regulatory backbone, proposing rules to prevent a repeat of the whole sorry saga. He is Gary Gensler, head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and he's dared to push the Treasury Secretary and other major bank overseers to join him in seriously limiting Wall Street's cavalier proliferation of complex derivatives. Analysts describe these convoluted schemes as poorly disclosed, poorly understood, and could lay waste to the economy. Good for Gensler, right? Yes, but of all the agency heads who are involved in writing new banking rules, guess which one was not invited this year by President Obama to stay on the job? Yes, the tough one, the one actually trying to protect the people, the one not afraid to offend Wall Street greed heads, Gary Gensler. He's being replaced by Timothy Massad, who appears to be more of an industry lapdog than a watchdog. Massad, a career insider, has been a corporate lawyer for banks, a lickspittle lieutenant for Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, himself an infamous Wall Street softy, and a blocker of tough provisions to stop big banks from unfairly squeezing hard-hit homeowners. Apparently, Gensler wanted to keep doing his work at this once-obscure agency, staying on guard against financial connivers trying to twist the rules to legalize banker robbery. But Wall Streeters certainly didn't want him there, and Obama bowed to them, displacing the one guy, the one regulatory chief, who had the guts and gumption to stand up to coddle bankers. This is Jim Hightower saying, not only is Gensler gone, but Wall Street now gets a regulator who's being entrusted to return the agency to obscurity. What a disgrace! Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So that's the question. Are we in favor of paid leave? I think I've made my case for it. Look, at the end of the day, we know, beyond exception, that paid maternity leave, paid family leave, gonna help women stay in the workforce and off of public assistance. And that's what society has said we want. Now, look, I'm also a fan of saying, look, we need to pay people to raise children. Evidently, right now, the economy is in such shambles, and wages have fallen to such a low level that you almost need two incomes just to survive and get the basics that kids are going to need. To bring children into this world now, you need to have a reasonable income that now it takes two parents to earn. And my thought is, you know, you want to talk about true family values. Give families truly an option to have a parent stay home, which, I got to be honest, four children is preferable. There have been numerous studies that show having someone at home to be there when they get home from school, to help them with their homework, and that their focus is not 40 hours punching a clock for somebody else, but actually spending the time to be active and engaged in that child's life is beneficial for them. We know that. But some of the other things, you know, by saying, you know, having a paid system, you're going to keep people off of public assistance. You're going to keep people from filing bankruptcy. And then there's the personal part of this, and I go back to my experiences. Those weeks that I was able to take, that I wish for every new father, absolutely precious. They're memories and moments that I will always cherish that time concentrated right there with my kids. Just beyond words. And, you know, for someone who spends my day doing a lot of talking, it's almost something I can't put into words how important that was, that bonding time. And from my wife's perspective, the fact that there was somebody else there as she was recuperating, as she was adjusting. Those are true family values. And the fact that we're in the company of Swaziland and Papua New Guinea, I don't even know if I'm saying either of those right, tells me that we're really behind the times. And there are countries around the world that say, you know what, for the first 2, 3, 5 years, you stay at home. And we will give you something like unemployment. Because we believe in that generation. I've always been a believer. And when my wife and I had kids, because my wife had a job, you know, she made good money. She didn't make union contract money. She didn't make what I was making driving a truck, you know, working 60, 70 hours a week. She wasn't in the $70,000, $80,000 range, but she was in the, you know, 40s. We couldn't live on that. So she's the one who got to stay home. But we decided when we decided to have children that someone had to stay home. And we were going to sacrifice and forego a lot of the things that, you know, our friends of ours who had two incomes were able to do. We were just not going to do it because it was that important that the kids had a parent home. And we said that she wasn't going to go back to work until all the kids were well into school, preferably through the elementary years. Because by the time they get into middle school, the schools don't want you to have anything to do with the kids. The kids certainly don't want you to have anything to do with the school. So it's kind of a nice breaking period. But at least through elementary school. And I'm of the mindset that should be our national thought process. That we want to encourage people to be able to take care of their families. And there's the economic part of this. Look, by taking people out of the workforce, even if it is for the short period of time, you're going to tighten the labor pool and thus raise wages, which is the other reason business will fight this tooth and nail. And it's interesting how Janya pointed out that you didn't have the fraud, you didn't have the abuse, and the businesses didn't go out. I mean, because it's all that they're telling us. Well, if we pass this, it'll just decimate business. Nonsense. We can do things like this because it's right for society. And I found it interesting. At the maximum, the highest, the biggest millionaire in the will only pay $227. It's going to cost about $2 a week. And I've said it should be like, me personally, I think it should be run like unemployment. And we've already got state networks in place. Because I'll be honest with you, I think unemployment should be 66% of your wage instead of the 40 or 30 that we see in a lot of states. But the 66% of your wage with a minimum just like this, that's, to me, I was just having a conversation with a friend today, and we were talking about Uncle Milton Friedman, and the idea of a negative tax, and the earned income tax credit, and all of these things where we're giving money to people in the workforce to prop up their consumption, because we understand we're a demand-based economy. For me, if we say, okay, we want to pull people out of the workforce because it's important that we raise children. It's important that those children have that start. But we don't want to take them out of the consumer market. We want to make sure that we have consumers to buy goods and all of those things, especially kids, people with children. It's a very conservative idea. Now, I don't think in this Congress you could get the earned income tax credit passed through. I think the Republicans have gotten so radical that even things that seem commonsensical or seemed, right in the 80s, 90s, or even the early 2000s, now completely off the table. And there's part of me that goes, I don't even know that the Republican Party anymore puts on the facade that they care about families. But for what shred may be left, this seems to me to be the right way. Now, you look at people who have taken, and there have been some studies on this, the average worker who would take the 12 weeks unpaid leave, they put the number at about $9,300 of lost wages if they took the full 12 weeks of unpaid leave. I think that's dangerous. Also, not surprisingly, when there was a poll done in the fall of 2012, 3 out of 4 voters said that they and their families would be likely to face significant financial hardship in the event that they fell ill, or one of their family members fell ill, or their child fell ill, or they had a child. 3 out of 4. Significant financial hardship if one of those events happened. Is that what we want for our families? I don't believe so. So I think this is a step in the right direction, even if it does take 2, 3, 4 years down the road. For me, it's right to be pushing it, which is why we're going to continue to talk about it. Going to take a quick break. Right back with Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Riders on the storm, into this house we're born, into this world we're thrown, like a dog without a bone, and we're out of home. Riders on the storm,
where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
L&M Hospital in New London, Connecticut has agreed to resume talks Monday to end the lockout of nearly 800 union nurses and healthcare techs. The AFT locals representing the healthcare workers say it's good news for the patients and all people in the region served by the hospital. The union insisted that its entire membership be allowed to sit in on the talks, so a federal mediator will be used to shuttle proposals back and forth between the union and management. The union says the talks are expected to focus on the core issue, the future of patient care delivery at L&M Hospital and its subsidiaries. The Milwaukee Community Coalition, backing the fast food workers movement for $15 an hour and the right to form unions, is behind an effort now to get dozens of fired McDonald's workers reinstated. The workers were abruptly fired with no explanation by the McPiles Corporation, owner of the 3 McDonald's stores where they worked. The boss is a capitalist pastor known in his military days as Robert McDonald's Piles. He owns at least 11 McDonald's stores in Milwaukee and is senior pastor at Milwaukee's Abundant Faith Church of Integrity. Jennifer Epps Addison is the executive director of Wisconsin Jobs Now. She says the community must take a stand to get these workers back to work and demand that Pastor Piles act in accordance with his professed faith to treat these workers justly in this holiday season.
Some of them actually showed up to work and found out that they didn't have a job anymore. This is not what we expect out of any business owner, but certainly not a business owner that's a pastor right before Christmas. This is why people want unions, because the best way to resolve a difficult challenge or even hiring decisions is to sit down across from the people who are making the profits in your stores and to negotiate a fair deal for that. We hope that the union will be able to help Pastor Piles negotiate a fair deal with these workers so that everybody can have a happy holiday season and go into the new year with safe and secure families.
59 locked out Chicago area Teamsters funeral employees have won their unfair labor practices charge against Service Corporation International. The National Labor Relations Board found merit in several of the charges filed by Teamsters Local 727. But Local 727 Secretary Treasurer John Coley says that while thankful the board ruled in the workers' favor, the punishment doesn't fit the crime. Coley says the company's actions have grossly and negatively impacted the workers, and the company deserves a harsher penalty. The company had to acknowledge that they broke the law and notify the workers that they won't do it anymore. SCI has refused the Teamsters' offer for the workers to return to work. The NLRB found that SCI illegally spied on union activity, threatened members with loss of vacation, and unlawfully solicited the workers to withdraw from the union. The workers have been locked out for 5 months.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So here we are, the end of this legislative year. And I got to be honest, I love the John McCain quote. Not always a huge John McCain fan. But he said, you know, when I'm at the old soldier's home and I sit down in my rocking chair, I'll say, boy, 2013 was a banner year. And banner year, I think a little sarcasm. A little sarcastic, because not much has really gotten done other than a whole lot of eye poking and bashing each other over the head, but not much in the way of accomplishment. Anyway, let's go to Washington, D.C. and find out what's going on in D.C. and around the world. I've got Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Ellen, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. And he was being, John McCain was being very tongue-in-cheek.
I can't imagine.
He's not a happy camper, and he is going to vote for the budget deal.
Okay, good. Well, you know, some people think it's good. Some people think it's great. I'm not so thrilled with it. I know for Congress it's going to be fine. We don't have to fight for the next 2 years over this. Everything else, I'm sure they'll be happy to fight over.
Oh, I'm sure they certainly will.
So what's, I guess, the big news today, evidently, the NSA ruling?
Yes, this is a very big news today. This was a Bush appointee who basically said, hey, this kind of surveillance is illegal, and it's not permitted, and obviously it's going to go up to the Supreme Court. But when you have somebody who is a George W. Bush appointee taking what many of us on the lib side view, this actually, you know, and it's interesting because the case was brought by Larry Klayman, who's very no, I mean, he's never met a legal case on the right side he doesn't like. But they are convinced that this has really been unconstitutional and unacceptable.
Yeah. You know, I had a guy who helps me coach my daughter's basketball team. He does online sales stuff, you know, for a bit large organization. And he was saying, you know, that the company that he works for has got, you know, data on half of the country, through cookies and other things online. And they've built profiles around all of this stuff and all of this information that's being compiled. Now, like he says, it doesn't have your home address and your social security or any of that stuff. And as I added, yet.
Well, that's so easy to get, it's staggering.
And that's what I said. I said, not yet. But, you know, it's interesting that, you know, on one level, and look, when the judge said it's almost Orwellian, when the Republican appointee, the Bush appointee says it's almost Orwellian, the only thing I disagree with is the almost part. You look at all of this stuff, and I think there's a lot right, left, center that you just go, it's getting out of hand.
Well, it has gotten out of hand, and that's exactly the problem. It's very out of hand.
But let me ask you, how do we put? Is it possible to put the genie back in the bottle? I mean, everybody.
I don't honestly think it's possible to put the genie back in the bottle as long as you have the internet. I really don't. You know. It's interesting. I use one of these methods for dealing with anxiety, depression, or whatever that's called a simulator, and there's three or four different kinds that are made. Well, every site I go to, I find an advertisement.
Yeah.
Because it follows you around.
Yeah, I mean, it's building an online profile, and that's what this guy does. The company that he works for, that's their job. They build online profiles, and they're, you know, so when you go, they offer you, as he puts it, they're offering you targeted ads, you know, just like radio stations do or anybody else, and that's how he sees it. But, you know.
But if these ads follow you around, it isn't the same.
Right. Well, I mean, he was telling me, you know, one of the people that he works with was saying that, you know, she looked something up on the internet, and bang, there was an advertisement in my email box, and he's going, well, yeah, and you know, I got to wonder how much of that is our future. Everywhere we go, will we be bombarded by things that we've searched for on the internet when they make that link? And to his defense, you know, he believes that the link hasn't been made yet, and that they're not going to make that link. I think it's really simple to make that link between my IP address, my credit card information, my home address, my social security, and then everything else. But, you know, there's just a lot of information out there about us. Let's get back to this decision, though. What is it going to mean now that he's decided that this is unconstitutional? What happens?
Well, obviously, the government is going to probably go immediately and ask the Supreme Court to stop his ruling. In other words, put an injunction on his injunction. Actually, so it can go through and they can continue to do what they want, and then it will be heard at the Supreme Court.
So here's an interesting question then, because the business-friendly Supreme Court hasn't found a business decision it doesn't like. Is this a business decision, or is this bad government?
This is a government decision.
No, I understand
it's
that.
It's a bad government. But, you know, the Supreme Court has often gone with the executive power.
Okay. Because I see this as, you know, by doing this, you're gonna do this to government, you know, the government's not allowed to hold our information, so to speak, but you've got these big corporations who could easily sell it. So you got to wonder where that decision would go. Just my thought.
What do you mean where it's going to go? I don't understand what you're.
Well, I mean, because I look at the Supreme Court as a very business friendly organization.
As my attorney once said to me, Ellen, and he's a very well known leftist attorney who was president what's the Left Bar Association? I'm blocking out of it. But anyway, he was. And he said to me, he said, Ellen, you and I have about as much chance of being a member of the Supreme Court as you know, we do being president of the United States. They just don't elect people who aren't part of the system.
Right. So by asking.
And I don't mean elect, I mean appoint.
Right. But I asked him that question is when they tailor their decision, they carve out government being able to do this stuff, capturing phone numbers and information and all this, but do they carve it out in a way that private industry can easily do it, and if government wants it, well, we can just buy that information.
Well, yes. I don't know where they're going to go.
Yeah, I don't either.
I think it's a good thing that the Bush appointee did this. I really do.
And I guess the other question then becomes is, you know, how far has all of this gone that you have a semi-lucid Bush appointee?
Well,
I mean, how far has the left gone to the wrong side of the aisle? Since this is Obama's doing, part of it, he continued it from the Bush years. You know, how far has the left moved to the right to where you've now got a Bush appointee on the other side?
But you know, it's almost like some of what we saw in the late 50s and 60s, where you saw Eisenhower appointees really going with more the liberal Warren court, et cetera, because the stuff was just so egregious.
Yeah, we've gotten that far then.
Yeah.
Wow. I wouldn't disagree, because I think we've gone too far to the radical fringe. And I look at the Affordable Care Act. You know, there was a guy from North Carolina that I talked about earlier saying that, well, you know, he tweeted out that that Obamacare has done worse to the country than Stalin and Hitler and terrorists have ever done.
Well, that's, of course, not true. but here's the thing, some things. You know, I remember when I was 13 years old, I loved to give this quote. My brother Michael, who's a very well-known leftist attorney, said I was on a plane ride with him. He took me, you know, 13 years old, as my older brother, and he said, all governments are bad and some are worse than others.
Yeah, well, when you allow them to act in secret, I absolutely agree. But I do believe when you have an open government where people are active, engaged, and informed with the idea that we can do better, I think, at least I hope, or I have to hope, that things would get better. But I look at your place around the world in Sudan. I guess a coup attempt in South Sudan today?
There was a coup attempt this morning in South Sudan. There are some tribal issues, and the vice president was of a different tribe, the tribe that we deal with, and the president's from is Dinka, and then there's the Nuar tribe of which he is part of, and apparently he is hooked up with the first. He wasn't the president of South Sudan before it became a country, but when it was sort of its own territory. John Garang, who was killed in a helicopter accident, and actually nobody believes that it was any kind of conspiracy or anything. I mean, they think it was actually a helicopter accident. And his wife apparently is hooked up with these other people. But apparently they were able to control the coup, and there you have it.
Wow. And, you know, what happens in the, I know you spend an awful lot of time there. What happens if you're in the middle of that? I worry for you. I worry for you, Alan.
Well,
every time you go there.
I've been in the middle of a coup in the Philippines. And, I was supposed to leave this morning for South Sudan, which got canceled. I was supposed to go to Congressman Smith. He would not have gone if there was a coup. But had I been there, there in Juba, which is the capital, the area I work in, the coup would not affect anything. But in the capital, they have now a curfew dawn to dusk, so I wouldn't have gone to my, there's actually two edible and quite good restaurants. So I wouldn't have gone there.
No. I keep telling my wife that one of these days I'm going to go with you, and she keeps saying I'm insane. But this is one of these things that you want to see for yourselves firsthand. And
you should come. You should come.
Well, if opportunity arises, I most certainly will. Let's move along. I understand the budget deal. Where's this going?
Looks like on the budget deal that they actually have an agreement, and it looks like John McCain and some others are going along, and it looks like even though Bernie Sanders might not vote for it, they have enough Republicans that will to get that 60 votes necessary for cloture to get the vote to the floor. Then it's a simple majority.
Now, can we have a simple one-man filibuster? Can we do the... the secret filibuster.
Well, they could. I don't think they're going to, because as I say, this time of year, the wife call or their husbands call and say, "Honey, you promised us."
Yeah.
You know, Aunt Hilda's Christmas party, whatever.
Yeah. Well, you got to take care of that. You got to take care of that. That's really important. I've been saying I don't think they should get Christmas. They should all get coal. Nothing in their stockings. That's what we should use coal for. Giving to our legislators
right.
For doing nothing. And now the real important news. I got to get your thoughts on is Jesus white? And is Santa Claus white?
Okay, well, let me just say something. I do work for Fox News Channel,
okay.
So I try and stay away
out of that.
From that discussion.
Gotcha.
But I will tell you that we all know that Jesus is not white.
Okay. Dennis Rodman in North Korea, good thing, bad thing?
I think it's a really bad thing. I mean, I think it's a good idea to do all this diplomacy, but he's freelance. And I think, you know, as somebody said, politics should stop at a water's edge, and we have to speak with one voice, particularly when it comes to North Korea, that is just a bad regime.
Did they throw him to the dogs? Did they really throw the uncle? Did they really throw the uncle to the dogs?
That's what we hear.
Because at first I heard they hung him, and now I'm hearing that they actually threw him to the dogs.
That's what we hear, and they kept dogs hungry for 3 days.
Wow. Jeez.
It's pretty disgusting.
At some point, don't you think that, and that's, did that come out in the state-sponsored news? Because at some point, don't you think that people go, holy moly, if he's doing that to his own family, what's he going to do to me?
Well, but that's, they already know that. And you know, what they do is they imprison people for three generations.
Wow. Yeah, so you can't pass anything down.
Not just
down.
You that they put in prison. They put your children and your parents in prison.
Wow, insanity. Anyway, Alan, I hope you have a good holiday season.
Well, thank you, and I know you're going to be with your kids and have a great Christmas, and I'll be talking to your fill-in, and then I'll hopefully be listening to you on the radio.
Yeah, and then the People's Tour for America, we're going to replay that amazing experience. If folks missed it the first time around, can relive our month on the road going across the country, investigating labor history, talking to folks all across the country. Alan, always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Never you will look back again. You fight on to the end. Together we will live on forevermore. Now we have defended from all things that are good. Now we are defenseless.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
The scandalous saga of the Wall Street bailout continues, for bank regulators are now watering down Congress's pathetically weak reforms. However, during the past 4 years, one fellow has shown some regulatory backbone, proposing rules to prevent a repeat of the whole sorry saga. He is Gary Gensler, head of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and he's dared to push the Treasury Secretary and other major bank overseers to join him in seriously limiting Wall Street's cavalier proliferation of complex derivatives. Analysts describe these convoluted schemes as poorly disclosed, poorly understood, and could lay waste to the economy. Good for Gensler, right? Yes, but of all the agency heads who are involved in writing new banking rules, guess which one was not invited this year by President Obama to stay on the job? Yes, the tough one, the one actually trying to protect the people, the one not afraid to offend Wall Street greed heads, Gary Gensler. He's being replaced by Timothy Massad, who appears to be more of an industry lapdog than a watchdog. Massad, a career insider, has been a corporate lawyer for banks, a lickspittle lieutenant for Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, himself an infamous Wall Street softy, and a blocker of tough provisions to stop big banks from unfairly squeezing hard-hit homeowners. Apparently, Gensler wanted to keep doing his work at this once obscure agency, staying on guard against financial connivers trying to twist the rules to legalize banker robbery. But Wall Streeters certainly didn't want him there, and Obama bowed to them, displacing the one guy, the one regulatory chief, who had the guts and gumption to stand up to coddle bankers. This is Jim Hightower saying, not only is Gensler gone, but Wall Street now gets a regulator who's being entrusted to return the agency to obscurity. What a disgrace!
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
I am so pleased to be your governor, and I ask you, give me your support as I run for governor again, because I am running for governor of Pennsylvania.
Hit the road, Jack. Don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack. And don't you come back no more.
What you say?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or get the Stitcher app and take the program on the go. So, did you see the Kelly file on fake news on Fox? Devoted more than 15 minutes on Wednesday talking about, well, you know, Jesus and Santa were white. She claimed that she was making an offhand, tongue-in-cheek comment. She said that sometimes that's lost on the humorless. I guess it's lost on me. I don't see the... Is there a punch, was that a punchline? Now, understand, I don't think she's ever told a funny joke on her program. I don't think anything that comes out of her mouth is generally funny, except for her take on the news, which is, well, funny in a sad kind of way. But her remarks on Wednesday... We're in response to a piece over at Slate that was making an argument for a black Santa or a penguin Santa. And, you know, I've got to be honest, I don't think her remarks were all that interesting. Just because it makes you feel uncomfortable doesn't mean it has to change. Jesus was a white man, too. It's like we have, he's a historical figure. That's a verifiable fact, as is Santa. I just want kids to know that. How do you revise it in the middle of the legacy in the story and change Santa from white to black? Okay, so you heard her statement. Where's the joke? Did I miss it? I think so. Now, again, I guess you can, you know, you can say whatever you want. I saw a bunch of right-wing shill groups saying, oh, see, now the liberals are going after her. They're trying to impugn her character. They're trying to assassinate her character because she's the only, and I love the one, I think it was the Center for Legitimate Governor or Americans for, I think it was Americans for Legitimate Government who had a piece talking about, well, the only way they can besmirch her good name is to go after this, because that's all they've got. And I guess part of me goes, well, she's the one with the most unsoiled reputation. Maybe that's bad for your, maybe it's just bad for your network. But again, you know, those of us who look at fake news on Fox as infotainment, not news, it's an ideology that's pushed more than its actual reality. It's, you know, you've seen these stories where, you know, two Fox and someone else cover a story and they're completely different because of Fox's ideological bend. Seems very, very interesting to me. Interesting news in New Jersey, though. I don't know if you saw this, but the guy who was Chris Christie's top appointee to the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, evidently he resigned on Friday because it's becoming more and more apparent that back in September, because the Republicans were angry, they actually ordered a whole bunch of lane closures at the George Washington Bridge. And I guess it's punishment for the mayor in that area, you know, who is a Democrat. The punishment, we're going to punish you. So evidently they closed a bunch of lanes, caused this huge traffic jam on the world's busiest bridge. Understand, the George Washington Bridge is the world's busiest bridge. I don't care what time of day you're going over the GW, it's backed up. There are just traffic all the time. And the fact, in my view, the fact that there's a toll booth there at all, it should be criminal. Because all you're doing is slowing things down even more. Eight lanes down to four, and then down to two? Really? Give me a break. Now, I guess as in looking at this, the scandal keeps growing because no one can figure out why they closed the lanes on the George Washington Bridge. And you know, the idea is, well, maybe it's this payback scheme, which I don't doubt. When you look at people like Christie and these very authoritarian figures, these very Machiavellian characters, it seems to me that this is something that they would do. But you look at it, and I guess another part of this story is another one of these people in this Port Authority who evidently ordered these lane closures, which caused this massive backup. Evidently, he was buying up internet domain names against political adversaries of Chris Christie. And the Record, you know, reported this. They bought up this guy, this Pat Foy's, anything you could do, you know, patfoy.com, I guess, .net.org.us.info, anything with his name, because yeah, they're gonna smear the guy. I just thought it was kind of interesting, the very Machiavellian characters that we have running our government. Also kind of sad. These are the people who tell us government doesn't work, and then they prove that they can't make our government work. Anyway, we at the Smith family heading away for our Christmas holiday till the end of the year. Pat LaMarche is going to sit in for the next couple of nights. Then we're going to replay the People's Tour for America. Back in June, we did the cross-country tour. This is an encore presentation. We're going to make sure that people get to see it. I'd love to hear your thoughts, your comments, your opinions on how we did. Also going to be a book coming out in the new year that we're going to get people access to. So I'm looking forward to that. I hope everyone has a safe, happy, and healthy holiday season, and we'll see you next year.
It's coming from the wind.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the time.
tides flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous raid. Democracy is coming.